You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. While U.S.-led NATO forces and Russian forces are engaged in building up their respective militaries on either side of Russia's western border, the ultranationalist fascist forces that were instrumental in the overthrow of Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, in 2014 have been flexing their muscles in Odessa. They have predictably received little attention from the U.S. media, which have downplayed their role in producing the third regime change involving the Obama presidency. Given their position in Ukraine's crumbling economy and the emergence of similar forces across Eastern and Central Europe, the importance of Ukraine's ultra-right should not be ignored or minimized. Today at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking about that subject and other related issues with Professor Nikolai Petrov from the University of Rhode Island, one of the country's foremost authorities on Russia and Ukraine affairs. Before I get to that, a little refresher on how a 21st century version of the Cold War came to be, which I reported to you back in 2014. It may be helpful. In December 2013, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland Kagan, spoke to the Ukrainian American Foundation in Washington and boasted that the United States had spent $5.1 billion on its efforts to overthrow the government in Ukraine, although the terms she used were a bit more diplomatic. I played the audio of her speech for you at the time, and you can still find it on YouTube. I also played for you a secretly tape recording of Nuland Kagan and Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine at the time, discussing who should be the country's prime minister following the coup against Ukraine's elected president, as the two have been openly plotting, aided by the U.S. NGOs on the ground in Kiev. Not surprisingly, following the coup, Nuland Kagan's choice, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, got the job. That audio as well can still be found online. What should be noted is that Nuland Kagan was Hillary Clinton's press spokesperson, while the former First Lady was Secretary of State, and should Clinton make it to the White House, it is more than likely she'll be appointed to a high-level foreign policy position. No less important is it that she is married to Robert Kagan, co-founder of the Project for a New American Century, the neocon think tank that brought us the Iraq War, and whose attitude towards Russia has not changed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Robert Kagan has already endorsed Clinton's nomination, and that should really come as no surprise because her foreign policy positions are identical to those of Kagan and most of his fellow neocons. That Clinton would hire Nuland Kagan as her spokesperson and that Obama would later appoint her as his Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia points to how little actual change there has been between the Bush and Obama administrations when it comes to foreign policy. It's important to recall Nuland Kagan's actions in Ukraine now because what it set in motion was the current confrontation between a remilitarized Russia and a re-energized NATO on its borders. This required NATO breaking an oral agreement that had been made with the Russians back in 1990 as part of its agreeing to the reunification of Germany that it would keep its distance from Russia's borders. Washington, as NATO allies, blamed Russia's annexation of Russian-speaking Crimea for today's heightened confrontation and as an excuse for moving its troops eastward, but NATO had in fact broken its word to the Russians 5 years earlier. It's worth mentioning that Crimea had been part of Russia from 1783 to 1954, at which time Ukrainian-born Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev arbitrarily transferred it over to the Ukrainian Socialist Republic while maintaining it as part of the Soviet Union. This fact was rarely mentioned by Western media. Back in 2009, then-Russian President Dmitry Medvedev had accused the West of breaking its promises regarding respect for Russia's borders. Washington and its NATO allies denied that any commitment had been made regarding the movement of its troops during the critical discussions over German reunification. It was the Russians who were telling the truth, however, as Germany's Der Spiegel magazine revealed, when newly discovered documents in Western archives supported Moscow's position. On February 10th, 1990, between 4 and 6:30 p.m., Der Spiegel noted, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher spoke with his Russian counterpart, Eduard Shevardnadze. According to the German record of the conversation, that had only recently been declassified, Genscher said, quote, "We are aware that NATO membership for unified Germany raises complicated questions. For us, however, one thing is certain, NATO will not expand to the east," end quote. And because the conversation revolved mainly around East Germany, Genscher added explicitly, quote, "As far as the non-expansion of NATO is concerned, this also applies in general," end quote. Shevardnadze replied that he believed, quote, "everything the minister," Genscher, "had said." Moreover, Mikhail Gorbachev claimed that Secretary of State James Baker had made the same commitment to him, and the expansion of NATO violated the spirit of agreements that unfortunately were not put in writing. To bring you up to date, Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said last Wednesday that Russia will deploy 3 divisions of troops along its borders to counter NATO's increasing military presence in Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of War Ash Carter said last week that NATO is considering stationing a force of around 4,000 troops in Poland and the 3 Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. This would be in addition to another deployment already authorized, the U.S. Armored Brigade, about 4,200 troops that will be sent to Eastern Europe in February. Carter said on Monday that the additional Eastern European force NATO is considering would consist of 4 battalions of soldiers contributed by NATO members on a continuously rotating basis. Meanwhile, in the wars of the Middle East that have no foreseeable end, a note of unwarranted optimism emerged. It was as connected to reality as what those in the mid-1960s heard from U.S. officials concerning the progress of the war on Vietnam. Quote, "So far in terms of what we had hoped to do, we are pretty much on track," said a U.S. official quoted in the Washington Post, who spoke on the condition of anonymity in order to discuss sensitive subjects. "We are actually a little bit ahead of where we wanted to be," he said. However, according to the Post article, quote, "the fight is entering what Pentagon officials have called a new and potentially harder phase, one that will entail a deeper level of U.S. involvement, but also tougher targets." In an attempt to ramp up the tempo of the war, the article goes on, the U.S. military is escalating its engagement, dispatching an additional 450 Special Operations Forces and other troops to Syria and Iraq, deploying hundreds of Marines close to the front lines in Iraq, and bringing Apache attack helicopters and B-52s into service for the air campaign. You remember the B-52s. They were used to bomb Vietnam back to the Stone Age, and they're still around, while the unindicted war criminals who ordered them into the air were allowed to retire or die in peace. Well, the extra resources, the Post article continues, are an acknowledgement, U.S. officials say, that the war can't be won without a greater level of American involvement. The targets that lie ahead are those that are the most important to the militant self-proclaimed caliphate, including their twin capitals of Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, and to a lesser extent, Fallujah, a key concern because of its proximity to Baghdad, end quote. Wrong. Fallujah should be a key concern to all Americans because it was a site of the first use by U.S. forces of weapons containing depleted uranium, the first in modern warfare. It devastated the people of that city far more cruelly than ISIS has done, and it was the Democratic Party leadership from the Obama White House to both houses of Congress that allowed the criminals responsible to get away with it. As Dar Jamal reported on Democracy Now 3 years ago, quote, "Noting the birth defects in the Iraqi city of Fallujah, they're extremely hard to bear witness to, but it's something that we all need to pay attention to. What this has generated is, from 2004 up to this day," said Jamil, "we are seeing a rate of congenital malformation in the city of Fallujah that has surpassed even that in the wake of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that nuclear bombs were dropped on at the end of World War II," end quote. Yes, it was something that we all need to pay attention to, and yet we didn't. Listeners of Sunday's weekend edition on NPR, particularly the nearly 500 residents of Mendocino County who showed up at Ukiah's Convention Center Saturday to hear Hawaiian Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard speak on behalf of Bernie Sanders' presidential candidacy were, I suspect, more than a little miffed. That's when they heard NPR's national correspondent Mara Liasson announce that, despite whatever happens in the remaining primary contest, and even if the party superdelegates vote the way their respective states have done up to now, it is, she said, quote, mathematically impossible for Sanders to get the nomination, unquote. While Senator Sanders' chances of getting the nomination at this point are admittedly slim, Eliason's statements were simply not true. What it reflected, as she demonstrated again yesterday and this morning, chipping in with additional comments denigrating the Sanders candidacy, is a thinly disguised effort of the media establishment, of which NPR and Eliason are signature members, to snuff out Sanders' historic presidential run and anoint Hillary Clinton as a Democratic nominee and the country's next president. A story in the online journal Political Monday told a different story. It reported that Clinton had resumed running TV ads on the eve of yesterday's West Virginia primary, concluding that, quote, Clinton's campaign is eager to stop Sanders from gaining momentum with a string of victories through May, end quote. I suspect they're even more eager today after Sanders drubbing him, Clinton, in the Mountaineer state. What must be worrying her and what might make the superdelegates think twice is that 4 out of 10 Sanders voters in West Virginia said they would support Trump if Clinton is the nominee. One superdelegate, our member of Congress, Jared Huffman, who initially indicated he would be supporting Clinton in Philadelphia, now says that he will vote for whoever has the most delegates coming into the convention. Should Sanders keep winning, particularly in California, it's more likely that other superdelegates will do the same by July's convention in Philadelphia. Despite lobbying efforts by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it appears that Washington will take a tougher tone with Israel in an upcoming report that takes the Jewish state to task over the expanding of Jewish-only settlements in the West Bank, the resumption of demolitions of Palestinian homes, and the seizures of land belonging to the Palestinians that ostensibly would be theirs in a future state. That's according to 3 unnamed American diplomats who spoke with the Associated Press. The report to be issued by the U.S. and its fellow members of the so-called quartet, the UN, the EU, and Russia and the United States, will also chastise Palestinian leaders for failing to rein in anti-Israeli violence, but the diplomats involved in drafting the document said its primary focus will be the surge of construction in Jewish housing in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. According to the AP, the U.S. approval of the harsh language marks a subtle shift. Washington has traditionally tempered statements by the so-called quartet with careful diplomatic language, but the officials said the U.S. in this case will align itself closer to the positions of the European Union, Russia, and the UN, who have been more critical of Israel's role in the Mideast impasse. While, as the AP notes, the reports released later this month is sure to infuriate Israel, this announcement several weeks in advance seems guaranteed, if not designed, to stimulate Israel's friends in Congress, as well as presumptive presidential candidates Clinton and Trump, to rise in Israel's defense and pressure the State Department to water down the text in alignment with the wishes of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Israel's domestic lobby. The report will be largely symbolic, requiring no action, but it could be presented to the UN and possibly sent to the Security Council for an endorsement, according to the diplomats. According to the AP, they demanded anonymity because they weren't authorized to discuss the unfinished work publicly. Now, that would seem to be a serious leak of critical information from within the State Department, would it not? But does anyone seriously think the leakers will be hunted down and punished? I don't think so. Now, according to the Israeli paper Haaretz, the quartet's report has largely become a Washington affair, with an American, Frank Lowenstein, taking the lead in drafting it, although U.N. Special Envoy Nikolai Mladenov and EU Envoy Ferdinando Gentilini reportedly were said to have offered suggestions. This week, the quartet delegates are meeting in Moscow to unify the various drafts so as to make the final document ready for the foreign ministers' summit in Paris on May 25th. This presumably gives the members of Congress as well as Clinton and Trump plenty of time to weigh in. Meanwhile, on the eve of the bid to have her church divest from companies allegedly profiting from Israel's control of the West Bank, Clinton has reasserted that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel's settlement policy is counterproductive to peace. Clinton was responding on Sunday to an appeal from the Israel Action Network, an affiliate of the Jewish Federations of North America, ahead of the quadrennial United Methodist Church General Conference that started yesterday in Portland, Oregon. In a two-page message, Clinton, who was raised and remains a practicing Methodist, did not directly mention the church, but repeated what she had previously told AIPAC's National Convention, quote, "The BDS seeks to punish Israel and dictate how the Israelis and Palestinians should resolve the core issues of their conflict," end quote. Meanwhile, in Israel, a portion of Holocaust Remembrance Day speech by one of Israel's highest-ranking officers has caused a furor that has yet to die down. Elements of General Yair Golan's speech drew so much harsh criticism that in some cases it complained, a Jerusalem Post writer, they overshadow the actual meaning of Holocaust Remembrance Day. What did Golan say? He said, quote, "The Holocaust should bring us together and ponder our public lives, and furthermore, it must lead anyone who is capable of taking public responsibility to do so. Because if there is one thing that is scary in remembering the Holocaust, it is noticing horrific processes which develop in Europe, particularly in Germany, 70, 80, and 90 years ago, and finding remnants of that here among us in the year 2016. Under withering criticism, Golan backpedals, saying that he did not mean to compare Israel or the Israel Defense Forces to the Nazis. Yet the Nazis fall into the time frame he discussed, noted the Jerusalem Post critic. Even accepting his clarification, they wrote, Germany 70, 80, 90 years ago was just too close for comfort to a Nazi comparison for many, especially on Holocaust Remembrance Day when we're mourning the 6 million Jews they murdered, end quote. Golan had one supporter in Environmental Protection Minister Avi Gabay. The Jerusalem Post quoted Gabay as pointing out that Major General Golan has enough perspective to be granted our attention without everyone pouncing on him. The harsh criticism is out of place. There is nothing similar between Israel today and what happened in the Holocaust, but there is definitely the budding signs of nationalism and racism that is reminiscent of Germany in the 20s and 30s, end quote. For anyone who has seen the YouTubes online of crowds of young Israeli men and women shouting death to the Arabs, that can be classified as an understatement. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinians' struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. This week we take another look at the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement that continues to come under attack by the powers that be in both Israel and the United States, which is a good sign in the sense that it proves that the movement is having an effect on the economy of Israel. Why else try to literally outlaw it, which is the current strategy? Today we begin with journalist Ali Abu Nima of the Electronic Intifada, speaking in Malaysia about the goals, advances, victories, and challenges of the BDS movement.
So I'm very happy to be here and very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you I believe that Malaysia has a critical role to play in the battle for justice in Palestine. The timing of this conference is absolutely critical. Let's just think about what has happened over the past year or so. It's just a few days past the anniversary of the ceasefire, or the so-called ceasefire, which was supposed to end the Israeli war on Gaza, 51 days of heavy bombardment, which killed more than 2,200 people, destroyed much of Gaza, killed 551 children. A year later, Israel continues to prevent reconstruction, continues to prevent any kind of normal life. A few days ago, there was a UN report that said that Gaza will be unlivable in 5 years. Gaza is already unlivable for the people who are there. No human beings should be subjected to what Palestinians in Gaza are being subjected to. I also note that here in Malaysia, this country has been a very welcoming host to many students from Gaza. I had the opportunity to meet a few of them this morning, but I also knew about you and your generosity and your passion for justice in Palestine from my friends Rifat Al-Arir and Yusuf Al-Jamal, who studied here in Malaysia. They're both back home in Gaza. They studied and taught here in Malaysia, and who speak with such warmth, and who told us, who shared with us the news of the work that you're doing and of your solidarity with the people of Palestine. Rifat is supposed to be here with us in Malaysia, but because of the Israeli blockade, aided by the Egyptian military regime, he is imprisoned in Gaza along with 1.8 million other people. So it's not just about construction supplies, it's not just about the basic needs, but even the human spiritual needs and intellectual needs are being blockaded in Gaza. The freedom to move, to study, to learn, to go where you want has been blockaded and destroyed by Israel and those who support it. We saw in the brief clips what's happening in the West Bank and in Jerusalem on an almost daily basis, the destruction of homes. I'm going to say more about that in a few minutes. But I just want to note at this point that there is no place in Palestine today. And when I talk about historic Palestine, I don't just mean the West Bank and Gaza. I mean all of Palestine, what is today Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. There is no place in Palestine where Palestinians are not under attack by the Israeli state. There is no place where Palestinians can live securely in their homes or on their land, whether it is in the Jordan Valley, which has mostly now been forcibly cleansed of Palestinians by Israel and its settlers, whether it is in the Naqab in the south, where Palestinian Bedouins are being constantly driven from their homes, whether it is in the north of Palestine in Galilee, or in the cities of Haifa, Jaffa, and Akka, where the remaining Palestinian communities are being slowly driven from their home, house by house, street by street, by the relentless colonization of the Israeli state. None of this is new. I suspect you've all heard it many, many times. We know that over the years, over the decades, there have been countless condemnations in the United Nations, in various international forums. We know that many governments, including the government of Malaysia, have repeatedly condemned these many crimes. Bless you, Sahai. I hope you're well. We know that this has been going on. Let's think back 10 or 11 years. One of these international decisions, an important one, was in 2004, when the International Court of Justice ruled that the wall Israel is building in the West Bank, a brutal, ugly wall of oppression, Palestinians call it the apartheid wall. Some of the media claimed that this is a wall to separate Israelis from Palestinians. This is a lie, as anyone who looks at the map will see. This is a wall to separate Palestinians from their land, and to separate Palestinians from each other, and to separate Palestinians from Jerusalem. It's not a wall that is designed to separate Palestinians and Israelis. And the International Court of Justice condemned it, and they said it was illegal, and that they said it should be torn down. Well, after that decision, we saw not one government in the world take any action. Not one. And it was at that point that Palestinians began, well, I won't say they began, they already recognized that if they simply wait for governments to act, nothing will happen. And so they had to take things into their own hands, as they had always been doing. But they also had to mobilize broad grassroots international support. And this was the birth of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, where Palestinians got together. They also met with comrades, brothers and sisters from South Africa who had had the experience of waging such a struggle. And they came up with the BDS call. We heard about it in the introduction, but maybe it's new to many people in this room. So let's just go over the ABC of BDS, the very basics of what it is. 10 years ago, July 9th, 2005, 170 Palestinian organizations representing the full spectrum of Palestinian society, still the broadest coalition in Palestinian civil society, issued the BDS call. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just read you some of the words because it really sums up the spirit. Given that since 1948, hundreds of UN resolutions have condemned Israel's colonial and discriminatory policies as illegal and called for immediate, adequate, and effective remedies, and given that all forms of international intervention and peacemaking have now, until now failed to convince or force Israel to comply with humanitarian law, to respect fundamental human rights, and to end its occupation and oppression of the people of Palestine. And in view of the fact that people of conscience in the international community have historically shouldered the moral responsibility to fight injustice, as exemplified in the struggle to abolish apartheid in South Africa through diverse forms of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and inspired by the struggle of South Africans against apartheid, and in the spirit of international solidarity, moral consistency, and resistance to injustice and oppression, we representatives of Palestinian civil society call upon international civil society organizations and people of conscience all over the world to impose broad boycotts and implement divestment initiatives against Israel similar to those applied to South Africa in the apartheid era. We appeal to you to pressure your respective states to impose embargoes and sanctions against Israel. We also invite conscientious Israelis to support this call for the sake of justice and genuine peace. These nonviolent punitive measures should be maintained until Israel meets its obligation to recognize the Palestinian people's inalienable right to self-determination and fully complies with the precepts of international law by 1. Ending its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the wall. 2. Recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens to full equality. And 3. Respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. That was 10 years ago. Now, I remember 10 years ago, well, even less than 10 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe even 1 year ago, there were many people who said, BDS, it's a waste of time. It's not going to have an impact on Israel. Israel is too strong. Its lobby is too strong. The governments that support Israel are too powerful, and they will never allow any harm to come to their darling little Israel. We heard these words many times, but they didn't discourage us, and they didn't discourage people all over the world who have been engaging in so many different kinds of BDS campaigns all over the world, in North America, in Europe, in Asia. Thursday, we had a gathering. I don't know if our friends are here from India today and from other countries in the region who are also getting into BDS. So this is already a global and a regional initiative. And in fact, I know that Anna will probably talk more about some of the victories, and there are far too many even for both of us to list, but I'll just give some headlines. Dr. Nazari mentioned Veolia. That was mentioned in the video from our comrade Mahmoud Nawaja of the Boycott National Committee. Veolia is a major international, multinational corporation. It's present here in Malaysia, as it's present in dozens of countries, running infrastructure, public transport, water, sanitation, and other services. This company has been the target of BDS campaigns for a decade because of its direct role in the occupation, helping the settlements, running bus services and train services for the settlements, and water and sanitation as well. As Mahmoud Nawaja said in the video, Veolia has lost more than $20 billion in contracts because cities across Europe and even in North America refused to give them business because of their role in the occupation. That was the direct result of grassroots campaigns of citizens who said that they would not tolerate a company like Veolia in their hometowns. Even the government of Kuwait cancelled a $700 million contract with Veolia because of its role in the occupation. And finally, just in the past few weeks, Veolia sold its last investments in Israel and got out completely. But what was interesting about that, while we're very happy to see Veolia forced to end its direct complicity in Israel's crimes against the Palestinian people, what we're happy about as well is that this had an important deterrent effect on other companies, because Veolia could find no other international companies who were willing to buy its investments in Israel. So very likely it would also have lost money by having to sell these investments at a discount to local Israeli investors, because no international investors would buy them. This points to something else, what Israel calls the silent boycott. That that it's always great when people of conscience and courage will stand up and say, I will not do business with an Israeli company or a company that helps Israel. I will not do a project with an Israeli university that is doing military research and involved in the crimes against the Palestinian people because my conscience does not allow it, because Palestinians have asked me not to, because it's an effective form of pressure. It's always great when people are willing to say that openly. But the silent boycott that Israel is afraid of is that lots of people, many more people, many more corporations are not willing to do business in Israel, but they don't say anything. And Israel is maybe even more scared of that. And there's good evidence for why. Dr. Nazari mentioned the report from the Israeli government that said that a consumer boycott in Europe could cost Israel up to 40 billion shekels, about $10 billion a year. But there's also evidence that investors are already staying away. Just a couple of months ago, the UN agency UNCTAD issued its latest report on foreign direct investment around the world, and it found that in the year 2014, the foreign direct investment fell 50% in Israel. In other words, many international investors who were willing to go to Israel before have decided to stay away. And what was so interesting is one of the Israeli economists who wrote the report for the UN said, we believe, this was quoted in the Israeli media, we believe that the reason for this 50% plunge in foreign direct investment in Israel is because of the war on Gaza and the boycotts Israel is facing. This brings up another issue, that there are many companies that simply, they don't want their name associated with Israel because of the damage it can do to their business in the rest of the world. So there are many examples. Others include divestment. I'll say more about that as well, and I know that Anna and Samah might say more about it too. This is when large institutional investors, whether it's pension funds or banks or sovereign wealth funds, withdraw their investments from companies complicit in Israel. And I'll say more about specific companies in a moment. And there is also the element of cultural and academic boycott. And there, I just want to point to this. Maybe we'll get into it more in the discussion. We'll have time for a discussion today. There is a Palestinian body called the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACB for short, and you can find them online at pacbi.org, PACBI.org. And they have published guidelines for the academic and cultural boycott, which explain in a very straightforward way what it is. The focus is, again, to hold institutions accountable. So Israeli universities, every single one of them, is involved in the oppression of Palestinians. This includes everything from military research, the fact that all Israeli universities help the army to develop weapons that are used to kill Palestinians, to universities providing subsidies to students and free tuition, free fees to students who participated in the war on Gaza last year, to universities that are involved directly in the confiscation of Palestinian land, like Hebrew University in East Jerusalem last year, or Tel Aviv University, which is built on the ruins of several ethnically cleansed Palestinian villages. Every single one of these universities is complicit. And not one Israeli university has ever condemned Israel's crimes against the Palestinians or condemned the Israeli occupation. This is important to remember because many of the opponents of academic boycott, the boycott of institutions complicit in Israel's crimes, they say, oh, but universities are places of learning and enlightenment. And the most enlightened segments of Israeli society, those who want to see peace and justice, are in the universities. Well, if that's true, why hasn't a single university spoken out? Why hasn't a single Israeli university ended its direct role and complicity in Israel's ethnic cleansing, apartheid, and war against the Palestinian people? Now, many European and American universities have direct contacts with Israeli universities, and their faculty and student of conscience are advocating to end those ties, to isolate those Israeli institutions. Malaysia won't have such ties between Israeli universities and Malaysian universities. However, many Malaysian scholars and academics are involved in international academic associations and can use their membership and their role in those international associations to advocate for isolating these Israeli institutions that are complicit in Israeli crimes. Now, in the opening, we saw some videos of home demolitions. And I want to focus on that for a few minutes, because one of the goals, an important goal of this conference, is to come up with some very concrete ideas of how people in Malaysia who care passionately for justice in Palestine can organize effective campaigns to put pressure on Israel. And in the end, it's going to be you in this country who decides what is the best way forward in your context, what will be the most effective campaigns. That's going to be your decision based on your knowledge of the context in this country. So I can only offer some ideas and leave it to your deliberations to look for a way forward. Now, one of the impressive things in Kuala Lumpur, yesterday we went up the Petronas Towers, and it's funny because I live in Chicago in the United States, and for many years we had the world's tallest building, the Sears Tower, and in the Petronas Towers we saw a diagram, and the Sears Tower is now very small compared to the Petronas Towers and others. Well, that's just the way it is. We have to accept that. But there were also many videos showing the construction of the towers, and there's no doubt that Kuala Lumpur is a city that is growing rapidly, and you might like all the development, you might not like it, but you see a lot of construction equipment in Kuala Lumpur everywhere. And in fact, most of us, when we see bulldozers or we see construction equipment, we do associate it with building, with creation. We may not like everything it creates. We may say there are too many shopping malls, there are too many tall towers, but it's generally associated with an act of creation. But since the start of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in 1967, in fact, since Israel's creation, heavy construction machinery has probably been the weapon Israel has used most against the Palestinian people, more even than warplanes, more even than tanks. Construction equipment has been the weaponry. Maybe we need to call it destruction equipment in the case of Israel. And this equipment has been used to totally reshape the landscape, to force Palestinians from their land, and of course for the building of the massive number of illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank, the wall which I mentioned, the creation of roadblocks, the creation of a segregated apartheid road system with first-class highways for Israeli settlers and secondary roads with many obstacles going through dangerous terrain for Palestinians. Israel doesn't make its own heavy equipment. Most of this equipment is manufactured abroad and primarily by American and European countries, the UK, JCB, Sweden, Volvo, Germany, the United States, Caterpillar, Japan, Hitachi, South Korea, Hyundai, and Turkey's Hydromech. And this equipment, we already saw it in action. I don't need to go into a description because you saw with your own eyes how it's used to make families homeless. Most of the companies that sell this equipment claim to have, claim to champion corporate social responsibility and ethical codes. Yet none of them has been willing to take responsibility for the systematic use of their equipment in Israel's war on the Palestinian people. And so I believe it's really an opportunity and the moment for us to demand that kind of accountability. There is a very detailed report, which I'm looking at now, on the role of these companies in the war on the Palestinians that Israel is waging. It's a report from a research organization called Who Profits, and it came out just last year. And it notes that since 1967, Israel has demolished more than 28,000 Palestinian houses, public buildings, and private commercial properties in the occupied Palestinian territories. This report predates, I believe, by a few months, the last war on Gaza. And so we can say that just in the last war on Gaza, Israel totally destroyed more than 12,000 Palestinian homes, severely damaged another 12,000, and did less damage to another 100,000. A lot of that destruction was done by aerial bombing, but probably the largest part of it was done with bulldozers, with Caterpillar bulldozers. And in fact, Israel started using these bulldozers on a large scale in 2008-2009 during Operation Cast Lead in Gaza. And they thought this was so successful from their perspective that they doubled the number of bulldozers in the Israeli army. They used more bulldozers than tanks in Gaza last summer to destroy homes. I know that Anna is going to talk more about the mechanics of a campaign, what it might look like, and some of the tactics that have been used. The point I want to make here is that I think Malaysia is uniquely placed because of its already strong public and passionate support for rights in Palestine to mount an effective campaign. And the role Malaysia can play is not just a national role, but a regional and international role. Because if Malaysia shows that such a campaign, there's been a campaign regarding Caterpillar for a number of years. Caterpillar is a U.S. company. But what if Malaysia were to focus, this is just a suggestion, on some of the companies that are located here in Asia? That could be a regional example that we could see our brothers and sisters in Indonesia following, in Thailand, and other countries. There are already campaigns underway in South Korea. So it would make sense to begin to speak and communicate with those who are in South Korea trying to hold Hyundai accountable, for example, and really to build an effective regional campaign. The first step, of course, is to engage with these companies and to say, maybe you didn't know about this. I think they do know. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say, maybe you didn't know. And give them an opportunity to correct their ways voluntarily because it's the right thing to do. And if they don't want to do that, to think about ways to put pressure on them. And finally, the other opportunity where Malaysia plays a key role, globally, there has been an incredible increase in interest in all kinds of Islamic financing, Islamic banking, Islamic investment funds, and Malaysia has certainly played an enormous role in the growth of Islamic finance around this region and around the world. And so another opportunity in this country is to approach Islamic finance institutions and ask them whether they are invested in these companies that research shows are complicit in Israel's crimes, international companies, and to engage with them to begin a process of ending their complicity. I know my time is out, and we'll have a lot of time for discussion. I am looking forward to the discussion today. I thank you again for this opportunity. Despite everything that has happened in Palestine in the past year and years, I have never felt more optimistic about the possibility of our action as citizens, as individuals, and as communities and organizations around the world to make a real, effective, and urgent difference to bring justice in Palestine, not in another 10 years. We just passed 10 years since the BDS call. We don't want to celebrate 20 years of BDS. We want to end it and bring justice before another 10 years passes. Thank you.
You have been listening to journalist Ali Abu Nima speaking in Malaysia on the BDS movement. And now we move right to another journalist, Max Blumenthal, being interviewed about the BDS movement on the Real News Network out of Baltimore. Here is Max Blumenthal.
It's been almost 10 years since the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS, began. Its goal is to increase economic and political pressure on Israel to end the occupation and the growth of Israeli settlements. And it's grown more and more in popularity. Celebrities from Desmond Tutu to Stephen Hawking support the movement. And just recently, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to create a blacklist of corporations doing business in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. This growing movement is making those from lobbying group AIPAC very worried, and our guest Max Blumenthal is here to discuss what their strategy is to crush the movement. Max is a journalist and author, and his recent article is titled The Israel Lobby's Dangerous Agenda for the U.S., Attack Free Speech and Criminalize Resistance. Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me.
So I just want to start off with, what is AIPAC's strategy?
Well, AIPAC in the past had never mentioned BDS, even recently. In 2011, when Benjamin Netanyahu spoke at this conference, which brings together a who's who of the pro-Israel lobby, 20,000 supporters is the main arm of the pro-Israel organizing in the U.S. Netanyahu did not mention Palestinians once in that speech. It was all about manipulating and badgering the Obama administration into attacking Iran on Israel's behalf. And it was all about Iran. He did not want to talk about Palestinians. He definitely didn't want to talk about the movement that Palestinian civil society has conceived that's spreading around the globe to pressure Israel to end its project of apartheid. And so fast forward 4 years later to 2015, last year, Netanyahu mentioned BDS 18 times. And now this year, AIPAC became a important campaign stop for all candidates except for Senator Bernie Sanders, who stayed in Utah and Arizona to campaign with actual Americans instead of to pander before a foreign lobby for apartheid, and struck a very different tone on Israel-Palestine, more akin to the kind of tone you might hear from an organization like J Street. The other candidates were united Hillary Clinton, the Democratic front runner, and Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and John Kasich in striking a very belligerent, militaristic, anti-Palestinian, even Islamophobic tone. Ted Cruz began his speech by denying the existence of Palestinians, essentially, a big applause line. Donald Trump turned the Verizon Center, filled with 18,000 mostly Jewish Americans, into the kind of Coliseum atmosphere that we'd seen at his rallies in the Deep South, showing that this kind of hate speech finds fertile soil not only among the stereotype of the Southern redneck, but also among affluent suburban Jews. And Hillary Clinton set the tone by attacking the campus left, kind of reverting to the Goldwater girl of her early days, trashing the campus left as anti-Semitic and demanding that the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, be stopped. Ted Cruz actually went a little further, called for criminalizing it by legally punishing any campus that implements a divestment measure against corporations involved in the Israeli occupation. So we're seeing AIPAC bring this agenda out into the open, not only through these candidates, but in state legislatures, where there are bills now being proposed from Massachusetts to California to actually outlaw BDS by punishing corporations who refuse to do business in Israel or divest from their Israeli holdings.
So I wanted to ask you about this, because in the U.S., First Amendment free speech rights are one of the strongest in the world. In Canada, there are hate speech laws, which make it it's sort of a different ballgame. So is there precedent for how they could go about attacking BDS by calling it hate speech, sort of like they're trying to do in Canada right now?
Well, the precedent lies in other countries that have less protection for free speech, which really reveals the pro-Israel lobby as the greatest threat to free speech in the West. They've already triumphed in France through the Alliot Memorandum, named after the former French justice minister, which is still enforced and has resulted in scores of pro-BDS organizers being brought to trial for their speech, for organizing in support of Palestinian equal rights. In the UK, you're seeing the conservative Cameron government attempt to pressure local town councils, actually to forbid local town councils from exercising their democratic right to divest from companies that do business in occupied Palestinian territory and weapons companies. So they're basically attempting to prevent them from enacting other progressive measures. And you can see the smears of Jeremy Corbyn and how Israel is being instrumentalized to break down progressive social movements across the West. In Canada, where you mentioned that there are hate speech laws, the government of Liberal Justin Trudeau has joined with the conservatives to condemn BDS in an official resolution, condemning it as a form of anti-Semitic hate speech.
Yeah, well, actually called it the new form of anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Which is just, as I've said before, it's absolutely disgusting, because they're actually setting parameters on who can be a Jew. Mm-hmm. Now, what they're doing in the U.S. To limit speech and to create a free speech exception around Palestine is to attempt to force universities and even state houses to adopt a definition of anti-Semitism that does away with traditional definitions of anti-Semitism, which define it as discrimination against Jews as Jews, and reorient it into discrimination against Israel, which is held up as the sole representative of world Jewry, according to this definition. It's been conceived by an Israeli politician of the Likud party who's a supporter of the settlement enterprise named Natan Sharansky, and he calls it the 3Ds definition, which is delegitimization and demonization of Israel. If you criticize Israel, you're an anti-Semite, according to this definition, and the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. has already forced the State Department to adopt this definition. And University of California's regents have just adopted the same definition, defining anti-Zionism, a political perspective, which is gaining in popularity among many Jews. I'm an anti-Zionist, as a form of anti-Semitism. So if an anti-Zionist is an anti-Semite, then who is a Jew? According to this definition, A Jew is necessarily a supporter of Israel, and anyone who stands outside those narrow ideological confines is not a Jew. And so Gentile authorities, under pressure from the pro-Israel lobby, are defining what it means to be a Jew. That's how dangerous it is. Beyond the free speech implications, it has implications for the future of Jewish political organizing. And I think we're going to see this division among Jews in the U.S. grow much more stark, in a much more stark direction.
Because even presidential candidate Bernie Sanders did sort of quite the BDS movement with anti-Semitism. Let's take a look at what he had to say.
She connected BDS to anti-Semitism. Do you think that's a fair linkage?
Well, I think there is some of that, absolutely. Look, Israel has done some very bad things. So has every other country on earth. I think if people want to attack Israel for their policies, I think that is fair game. But not to appreciate that there is some level of anti-Semitism around the world involved in that, I think would be a mistake.
Max, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that what you heard that Sanders said, it's legitimate to attack Israel's policies. And then he made this vague statement that there is a lot of anti-Semitism out there. And I'd actually agree, there is a lot of anti-Semitism out there. Israel and Zionism, which have become a sort of political, Zionism is the ideological foundation for Israel, which has occupied Palestinians for 50 years and maintained a project of apartheid for 68 years, has inspired anti-Semitism across the Arab world. It is the primary catalyst for anti-Semitism, and if the Arab world is the main vehicle for anti-Semitism, then it's because of Israel. And I would say, I would venture to say that that BDS, which will actually relieve Jewish Israelis of the obligation to be occupiers, colonizers, and to conscript into an occupying army, might actually reduce anti-Semitism if it were ever implemented, if equal rights were ever implemented, something Bernie Sanders claims to support, at least in the United States. So I think his statement in one way was helpful, and in another way, he doesn't analyze the roots of anti-Semitism, because if there is anti-Semitism, we have to fight it. But if everyone is called an anti-Semite who's a critic of Israel, then it negates the power of the accusation of anti-Semitism, and it makes it impossible for us to fight the real anti-Semites who can now wear it as a badge of honor and call themselves free speech champions. We've already seen white supremacists and neo-Nazis do the same thing in Europe. So the pro-Israel lobby is actually creating a scenario where that is almost inevitable.
So I actually want to ask you about legislation. So Canada passed a law in February, a motion in February, condemning BDS. And as we said, Prime Minister Trudeau even called it the new form of anti-Semitism. And then we have a UK law that says publicly funded institutions cannot boycott goods from the settlements. So why do you think governments are so aggressively going after BDS right now?
You have to look at the situation that Israel's in. It's under the control of the most right-wing government in its history, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's, who used to be considered the extreme edge of the right wing in Israel and is now finding himself under extreme pressure from his right wing. The occupation is firmly entrenched, and the West Bank is on its way towards being annexed as part of Israel, as part of Greater Israel, which would be apartheid Israel. The Green Line, which was supposed to provide a border between a future Palestinian state and Israel, is gone permanently. That's something even Barack Obama and Angela Merkel have acknowledged. And the Iran deal is ratified. The pro-Israel lobby has nowhere else to go except to attack the last line of resistance. And the last line of resistance is in capitals across the West, on campuses. It's BDS. And so the occupation of Palestine is being projected outwards in peripatetic fashion, and it's moving into our own societies through the pro-Israel lobby. And with it, its totalitarian nature. The great Israeli philosopher Yeshayahu Leibovitch referred to Israel as the only totalitarian country in the enlightened world. And he was referring to the way that it promotes itself as this enlightened democracy with gay rights and women's rights and voting, while it shutters Palestinian media outlets, raids Palestinian homes, takes their children out of their beds and puts them on trial before a military court and throws them into cells for months and months for nothing. That system is moving outwards through Netanyahu's cutouts. And it's political pressure, not the actual interests of governments in the UK or France or the US that are responsible for these laws and these anti-democratic measures. It's political pressure from a pro-Israel lobby that has a totalitarian agenda to crush and criminalize all opposition. I don't think I'm being extreme when I say that the pro-Israel lobby's agenda across the West is to outlaw all criticism and dissent against Netanyahu's apartheid Israel.
Do you think that also it might have to do with BDS gaining a lot of momentum?
Well, the success of BDS is the fact that we're talking about it right now and that every presidential candidate is required to address it and call for crushing it. That means that Palestinians who have otherwise been disappeared are on the agenda. And as I said at the beginning of this discussion, Netanyahu in 2011 at AIPAC did not feel the need to mention Palestinians once. Now it's all about Palestinians and the global campaign, which I think is one of the defining human rights causes of our time, for their liberation. So that's where BDS has triumphed, is forcing Israeli apartheid and the struggle for Palestinian liberation onto the agenda of politicians across the West and the public as well.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. We go riding in the damp, foggy midnight.
You're listening to episode 739 of Unwelcome Guests, The Devil's Chessboard. I'm Robin Upton, and we have two pieces for you this week. The main one, which we shall hear in just a minute, is an interview of David Talbot about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, which focuses on Alan Dulles and his role within the CIA. Now that is 1 hour and 40 minutes. That left us with a small space to fill, and I thought, well, it's time for this, because I've been waiting for more material about the Bank for International Settlements, I think a very important and under-researched topic. Well, I'm going to conclude with author Adam Labore being interviewed about his book on the Bank for International Settlements. Now, without further ado, let's hear the following interview. This is from October 2015, and it's carried out by Len Osanek and Jim DiEugenio. I took it from episode 755 of Black Ops Radio. Many thanks for that audio.
Can you give us a brief background of your writing and interest in this topic?
Well, it came out of my previous book, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, in which I followed Bobby Kennedy's investigative path as he privately explored the assassination of his brother. And I know from my research on that book that Bobby, pretty quickly after the assassination, almost immediately, in fact, was looking at the anti-Castro operation run by the CIA as the source of the plot against his own brother. And so I continued to follow that trajectory for the 5 years that Bobby lived until he himself was assassinated in 1968. But Bobby obviously didn't have access to all the information that we later developed, we being the JFK research community and various investigative projects, the House Select Committee on Assassinations and so on in the 1970s. So obviously there was a wealth of new information that Bobby Kennedy, despite the fact that he was an expert investigator and, of course, was plugged into a lot of corners of American power, but even Bobby didn't have access to the full story, I believe. So I was always haunted by the question, you know, if Bobby continued to pursue the case, what would he have found out? Who was responsible for killing his brother and who should have been put on trial? And so it was in a conversation actually with Peter Dale Scott, and I'd begun to think heavily about Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA who was fired by President Kennedy, as my chief culprit for a number of reasons. But it was during a conversation with Peter Dale Scott one day in Berkeley where it all kind of came together, and I tell this story in the book, how Peter mentioned as a young professor at Berkeley, he was invited to a conservative conclave, this dinner held at the home of W. Glenn Campbell, the founder of the Hoover Institute, the right-wing institute here in the Bay Area at Stanford. And this was, I believe, in 1962. It was a very conservative group, and they spent most of the dinner table conversation railing about Kennedy, this weak president who was destroying the country and putting the country at risk and so on. And Peter actually was not that political at that point in his life. And he was kind of astonished as a Canadian, a polite Canadian, and a former diplomat. And that's why he'd been invited to this dinner party. He had served in Poland and knew a number of people in the anti-communist exile community in the United States. But he was kind of shocked at how venomous the conversation was about Kennedy. And finally, a Russian exile priest who seemed to be the alpha male in the room got up. Peter didn't remember his name and kind of quieted everybody and said, "Don't worry, the old man will take care of it." And Peter thought at the time that he was referring to old Joe Kennedy, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, who was supposedly going to get JFK under control. But I had known that by that point, Joe Kennedy, of course, was all but incapacitated by a massive stroke he'd had in late 1961, I believe, December 61. And he was in no position to advise his son at that point. But I did know from my research that the old man was the nickname that Alan Dulles was known by within the intelligence community very affectionately, the old man. So that, you know, triggered a series of then thoughts in my mind, and that's really how the sort of the book began to take shape.
Now, this Dulles era, do you want to describe what you think the Dulles era, what people should come away with if you're thinking about John and Alan and what they represented?
Yeah, well, this is the lawless era that America continues to operate within, and in many ways, the Dulles era is the beginning of everything that we're grappling with today. America is perhaps the most dangerous and lawless country in the world. And this precedent was set, the stage was set for this during the Dulles period. Every president virtually that the Dulles brothers served, particularly Alan Dulles, was manipulated by the Dulles brothers, particularly Alan was subverted. The presidencies were subverted, I would go as far as to say, by the Alan Dulles. All the kind of controversial policies from torture, extraordinary rendition, extralegal assassination, subversion of foreign governments, even foreign allies, massive surveillance of private citizens, on and on down the list, all these things that we associate with the post 9/11 era actually have their origins in the Dulles era.
And I guess that's where the title comes from, because you make the reference there that I think you're being light on him, just calling him the devil.
Well, I couldn't find any horns on him, but I do think, yes, he symbolized a kind of the evil of power in a way. You know, some people call him a psychopath, you know, and sort of he had this cold amorality, I think. He was able to send people to their death without blinking an eye. He regarded his own children, his own family with kind of a cold detachment. He, again and again, you know, he put his own son in the hands of MKUltra doctor who performed experimental and very brutal treatments on him. Yeah, I mean, this is a man who's virtually capable of anything.
Yeah. Now, before we get too in-depth here, because that's the good thing about this book, and I really recommend it. I bought the audio version of it, so it's over 24 hours long, so I know that's how long it'll take someone to listen to it. But you go into in-depth from a very almost a childhood and to their family history. And but before I get too far in, where can we get the book? And do you have a website that there's more information?
Well, of course, I encourage everyone to buy the book at their independent bookstore. In fact, because of the support of independent bookstores here in California, the book has already become a bestseller in California. And that's despite the kind of media blacklist of the book, at least mainstream media. So I would encourage people to support their independent bookstore, but it's also available on Amazon.
Right, and I got it at audible.com, my copy.
Right.
Okay, Jim, do you? Me and Jim both have a series of questions we'd like to bring up, but go ahead, Jim, if you want to start.
On the last go-round, it's really kind of funny because back in the 90s when I started to do a lot of talks on the JFK case and I would get to a certain topic like Mockingbird, I would preface what I was going to talk about and I would say something like this. I would say, like most of the bad things in American life, it began with Alan Dulles. Okay, so I'm really glad that he made that sort of like the coda to his book, you know, that so many of the horrible things that we have to put up with in American life today began with the Dulles brothers, you know.
And I know, and I wasn't the first, obviously, to start to focus on Alan Dulles. Jim, I was aware of, you know, your writing about Dulles as well, and there were a number of other researchers I know who are looking in that direction. But I just felt this had to be given a book-length treatment. But he was emerging, I think, in some circles, including the ones that Jim, you know, frequents, as kind of, leading suspect in the case.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I believe. He begins the book with a really memorable scene, okay, between Alan Dulles. Was Dulles in Bern in World War
II? Yes, in Switzerland, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And he's negotiating with some baron who's the representative of Heinrich Himmler,
mm-hmm.
okay?
And the Nazi prince, this emissary was called.
Right. And so it's a very great way to begin the book because, as Talbot says, he goes, Roosevelt had given orders that there would be an unconditional surrender, meaning there was no negotiating with anybody. All right, you know, America and England were going to lay down the law at the end. So here you have Alan Dulles actually disobeying Roosevelt's orders and negotiating off the books with a representative of the SS commander-in-chief, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really good way to begin the book because it shows that Dulles didn't obey anybody's orders. He conducted his own foreign policy according to what he wanted to do. And to hell with everybody else.
Precisely. And I think that's why he wanted to be stationed in Switzerland during the war instead of London, where most of the OSS was, because he knew he would have very little supervision in Bern, Switzerland, because it was closed off. The Nazis had encircled Switzerland. Obviously, it was ostensibly a neutral country, but of course, in many ways, it was collaborating with Nazi Germany. The banks, of course, were laundering Nazi assets and so on. And so he was in heaven there. He was really on his own, by and large. He could defy Roosevelt's policy. And at the same time as he's meeting with these Nazi emissaries who are slipping across the border to talk with him, he's also meeting with brave Germans, like Schindler types, who one man named Edward Schulte, who was a businessman, who saw the beginning of the construction of Auschwitz and frantically crossed the border at risk to his own life, to inform Alan Dulles, who was supposedly the representative of the Roosevelt government, and he thought that Dulles then would alert the world and alert the Roosevelt administration to this horror, the final solution that was in the early stages. But Alan Dulles wasn't concerned about the plight of the Jews. He actually sat on that information. We know from reading his cables back to Washington, he never made the plight of the Jews his number one concern. He was indifferent. And what he really was concerned about was making sure that Nazi Germany emerged from World War II as a strong bulwark against the Soviet Union, which he always thought, even during the war when the Soviet Union was taking the brunt of Hitler's onslaught, he always thought that Russia was the main enemy.
Right.
So he was performing treasonously throughout World War II. As Jim said, he was subverting Roosevelt's policy, the Allied policy of unconditional surrender, and he was doing business with his old friends because, of course, he and his brother Foster go way back with these Nazis, back to their days at Sullivan and Cromwell on Wall Street, their big law firm where they have clients like IG Farben, which, of course, is the notorious chemical company, a German company that produced Zyklon B, among other things, the pesticide that was used to exterminate Jews. And they're exchanging, you know, cheery Christmas cards back and forth up into, really, into the war years. So, you know, they were quite comfortable, and Alan in particular, associating with the devil.
Yeah, well, isn't your first chapter called The Double Agent?
Exactly. I see him as a double agent.
Right, right. He's working both sides, the Americans and the Germans, as he's in this. And Dan, that's a very good point you brought up, that at Bern, you know, he basically didn't have a lot of supervision, you know, so he'd conduct his own foreign policy, you know, any which way he wanted. And as that's a very great title, Double Agent, because, you know, when you go into the whole history of the Dulles brothers, one of the reasons Sullivan and Cromwell was so prosperous is that they had no compunction about dealing with these Nazi companies all the way up, and as David just said, probably actually into the war.
Mm-hmm. Arthur Goldberg, who worked with Dulles in the OSS and later became a Supreme Court justice, said later that the Dulles brothers both should have been put on trial for treason. And I believe if Roosevelt had actually lived and the New Deal had continued into the post-war years, there's a very good chance there would have been a so-called banker's trial, when a number of these bankers and industrialists would have been put on trial for collaboration. You know, Foster, back in New York, still running the law firm during the war, was doing all he could, along with his associates, to hide the assets of Nazi clients of his so they couldn't be seized as enemy property. There were a number of major American corporations that were collaborating the same way secretly, Standard Oil, General Motors, and so on. So, you know, there would have been a reckoning if that presidency had continued into the post-war years.
I'm not sure if this is in your book, but you probably came across it. Didn't Sullivan and Cromwell set up shell companies for IG Farben?
Yes. So their assets wouldn't be seized
right.
by the Roosevelt government.
Right, right. Now, I don't know if you ran across this. There was a great New York Times article on this, in which an investigator in the Senate or something said, after studying Farben, he goes, there's no doubt about it. Farben was Hitler, and Hitler was Farben. That's how
yes.
important Farben was.
And these companies were interlinked. They would have subsidiaries, German and American companies, that were connected. And so at one point it got so absurd that in hiding these assets, they were protecting these companies. And the technology that America needed to pursue the war, diesel technology, fuel technology, and products were being kept from the U.S. military. So you could say, I mean, that was a direct subversion of the war effort that was being undertaken by corporate clients of the Dulles brothers.
Right.
That's why people like Goldberg later thought they should have been put on trial for treason.
Yeah.
Clearly, they put the interests of their clients, even when they were Nazi-related or Nazis, above the good of the country and the war effort.
Yeah. So, like you clearly delineate in your book, what Dulles was doing in Switzerland there was simply an extension of what he and his brother had been doing for Sullivan and Cromwell.
Yeah, and it continues, of course, till the very end of the war, and this was the other key thing he did. So he engineered something called Operation Sunrise, which was a top secret plan and had to be secret again because it violated, once again, the official Allied policy of unconditional surrender that had been worked out at the Casablanca conference with Churchill and Roosevelt. Stalin wasn't able to come because he was busy trying to win the Battle of Stalingrad, which was, of course, a turning point in the war. But at that conference, to assure Stalin that he wouldn't be stabbed in the back, Roosevelt very strongly lays out this policy of unconditional surrender. No, we're not going to cut any separate deals with the Nazis. We're going to crush this regime and bring its leaders to justice. But at the end of the war, Dulles is again very busy trying to cut a deal with Nazi forces in Italy, primarily Karl Wolff, who's the former liaison between Hitler and Himmler. You can't get more criminal than that, and is now in charge of all security forces, including the SS, in Italy. But he was a shrewd guy, and he knew his days were numbered. He knew he would end up in a war crimes trial, so he spent the last weeks of the war frantically trying to cut a deal with Dulles. And Dulles, because he's very concerned about stopping the Red Army from overrunning Western Europe and coming into Italy, is very intent on also cutting this deal. And so they do in the final days of the war. It doesn't really say they, you know, Dulles later presented it as a major strategic victory because it stopped bloodshed and destruction in Italy. Well, it really didn't save any lives. It was only 5 days before the general surrender in Germany. The only necks it saved were Karl Wolff, this SS general, his neck, and those of his top aides, all of whom should have been put on trial at Nuremberg. You know, Karl Wolff was responsible for keeping the trains running on time for Hitler to the camps. He ran as the head of the SS in Italy. He tortured and executed Italian partisans. He even tortured and executed American agents, intelligence agents who worked for Dulles. And yet this, you know, he was cutting a deal with this guy. One of his top aides, one of the top people who worked with Karl Wolff in Italy, Walter Rauff, was another notorious war criminal who invented the first tool of the final solution. You know, before the camps were built, what they would do, the Nazis, were they had these mobile trucks that they would run around the battlefields and the front and the Eastern Front and round up Jews and put them in the back of these vans. And they had the gas lines then were attached into the compartment where the Jews were stuffed. And they would gas them to death in these mobile death vans. They're hideous instruments of death. And they were so hideous that the Nazi soldiers who were forced to clean up afterwards were so repelled and sickened by it that they knew they needed a more efficient assembly line of death, which is why they began building the concentration camps. Well, this guy, this is his brainstorm, these mobile death vans, Walter Rauff, ends up in Italy and is hidden away in a luxurious apartment at the end of the war, along with some of these other notorious war criminals, where James Angleton, who's Dulles's, of course, close deputy and later head of counterintelligence under Dulles at the CIA, and really sort of our top intelligence guy in Italy because of his family's roots there, he installs these war criminals there to hide them from American intelligence agents who are searching for them, to put them, you know, so they can face justice. And just as quickly as they would be rounded up and put in jail, Angleton and his associates would let them out the back door. Walter Rauff ends up being tipped off before a raid. He flees. He gets to, I believe he ended his days in Chile, where he worked with the Pinochet government as a top intelligence advisor and, of course, on torture and so on. So these were the kind of men that Dulles rescued and rehabilitated after the war.
Now, I guess we should make one more mention here about the end of World War II. And that, of course, is another guy that Dulles was instrumental in getting out of the clutches of Nuremberg, which, of course, is Reinhard Gehlen. And yeah, he did a really nice job on Dulles getting him to the baseball game.
Exactly. I began the chapter that way.
Yeah.
Here's Reinhard Gehlen, who was Hitler's top spy on the Eastern Front. And he's sitting at a ball game with his deputy, who, you know, served with Gehlen throughout the war. It turns out the deputy was a baseball nut, this German, this Nazi. And they're sitting, right, this courtesy of the CIA, they have tickets to the 1951 World Series, the final game of the series where Joe DiMaggio plays his last game. He retired right after that. So they're taking in the game. You know, Dulles later said, well, I know this guy Reinhard Gehlen isn't, you know, the nicest chap, but you don't have to invite him to your club. But, of course, he did invite him to the club. He not only got him World Series tickets, he invited him to his club in Washington whenever he visited. He wined him and dined him. And they exchanged, you know, Christmas cards and birthday cards. And he basically supported him after the war as his rise within the West German power structure and helped install him as the top spy master under Chancellor Konrad Adenauer. So a post that he held throughout much of the Cold War. He was a very powerful figure.
Now, and, David, you mentioned postcards and that. You've gone through a lot of the journals and daily calendars of Alan Dulles. That's something that I don't think a lot of people have ever gotten to get that insight. Can you describe some of the things that you found?
Well, you know, he was very proud of some correspondence. So you think, you know, of course, they were heavily purged, these files. So, you know, God knows what Angleton and others burned after Dulles died in 1969, you know, Angleton quickly swooped down, along with his other associates and mechanics, CIA mechanics, into Dulles' home in Georgetown and went through all the files and everything. So, yeah, the files that are at Princeton, where Alan Dulles' papers are kept, of course, are heavily purged. But it's funny, they, you know, what they allow to stay in those files. And some of the things that are very interesting are his day calendars, and we can talk about that, some of the revealing things in his day calendars that he kept throughout the his life, his career, up until his death. And, you know, again, there are some interesting days that are blacked out heavily, like when he went to Dallas in 1963, I believe it was August of 63, and of course Kennedy's killed in November of 63.
No, you know, it was October of 63.
Was it October? Yeah, thank you. Some of the people he was seeing there were blacked out. But you do still get an interesting sense of some of the people he's meeting with and the correspondence. And, of course, he's very proud of some of his correspondence. And now, of course, it's particularly revealing, like, how cozy his relationships were with top media executives and editors and so on. I mean, this guy had the American media totally wired. So it just makes me laugh when people say, well, you know, we live in such a media-saturated society. You know, we know everything about everyone's celebrity sex lives and everything. You know, how could they have possibly conspired to kill the president? The media would have been all over this. That just makes me laugh as a journalist who spent my entire life in media, you know, when I see how the sausage gets made or doesn't get made. I mean, the American media, the press corps, particularly the Washington press corps, are some of the most timid and complicit professionals in the world. And they were very cozy and complicit with Alan Dulles and his regime at the CIA. I mean, many of his files in which there's, you know, letter after letter back and forth between him and the top editors of the New York Times, at Henry Luce's Time Life Empire, at the Washington Post, at Newsweek, at CBS, on and on. You know, Allie, they're calling me Allie. He has nicknames for them. They're going to see him at the club. You know, it was great to go on vacation with you. One letter from, I quote in the book, from the Newsweek editor right after the Warren Report is released, which, of course, Alan Dulles was heavily involved in as a member of that commission, in fact, someone who dominated that commission. And this editor, I think he was the head of the Washington Bureau of Newsweek at the time, says, "Dear Mr. Dulles, thank you so much for helping direct and, you know, our coverage of the Warren Commission."
Yeah, I just read that this morning. Yeah, that was really funny.
So Dulles, of course, is proud of that stuff. So he's all in those files.
Yeah, and let's not forget, which I think you very wisely made a key point in your book, is the whole Charles Murphy, Henry Luce operation with Dulles and Hunt after the Bay of Pigs, when Dulles realized that Kennedy was going to dump him, okay, over that whole affair. And he got out his cover story with Charles Murphy, you know, at Fortune.
That's right. Charles Murphy was basically his ghostwriter. He in fact, helped write the eulogy for Dulles' funeral.
Yes, really funny.
With Angleton. So here was a guy who was a top reporter in the Luce Empire at Fortune magazine. Right, and he's doing all this ghostwriting for Dulles throughout his career. Until for his funeral.
I found this day calendar and the appointments, even though they don't have the minutes of what they spoke about, very interesting. And like you mentioned, Dulles, I think a lot of people here are interested to see what kind of ties there are between this intelligence agency run by Alan Dulles and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And let me pose a question to you this way. Are you surprised in your investigation to find out about Alan Dulles's, quote, retirement? Because you go into in detail that you'd think that he was fired, forced to retire, but what you discover is something entirely different.
Yeah, Len, I think that is one of the key contributions the book makes. I'm not aware of others who've made at least a strong case for this in book form, which is that Alan Dulles didn't get the memo when he was fired by Kennedy. Of course, Kennedy is furious with him after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, the CIA operation in Cuba. His days are numbered after that in April 61. By November, he's officially gone. He's out. And he does go through a brief period of, you know, being a little bit disoriented and his whole life has been in power. And suddenly he's, you know, supposedly retired at home in Georgetown. But he really bounces back pretty quickly. And he begins to see a steady stream of his top aides, people like Angleton, Helms, and so on, and sort of more the operative types, too, as well. Howard Hunt and others stay in touch. He's going to conferences. He's going to meetings. He's meeting with people at his clubs. He starts to finally speak out against Kennedy. He's, I believe, involved in secret operations that subvert the Kennedy presidency abroad, particularly in Italy, which I go into in the book. And basically what Dulles does in so-called retirement is to set up an anti-Kennedy government in exile out of his home in Georgetown. And some of the people he's meeting with, in fact, are later tied by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, among other investigators, to the murder of the president in Dallas, including Howard Hunt. So,
well, can you go into that a little further? Because it's almost as if John McCone is just keeping the chair warm. And as you reveal, these people are coming and going, and it's like Alan Dulles is still there running the ship.
Yeah, well, John McCone, of course, is this Republican businessman, and he was served in the Eisenhower administration. But he's not a CIA guy. He wasn't one of the old boys. And he basically shared Dulles' worldview and his strong anti-communist perspective, and he kept those policies going. And the Kennedys came to really regret, I quote, this conversation between JFK and Bobby Kennedy in the White House that was taped because JFK had his own taping system. And they're ragging on John McCone. And JFK's realized, of course, what a mistake it was, and saying that he's, you know, stabbing us in the back all over Washington, which was true. You get that sense from Arthur Schlesinger's journals as well. Arthur Schlesinger is going to many of the same parties on the Washington circuit where McCone shows up, and he's like, you know, McCone is openly denouncing Kennedy, everything, his economic policy, his foreign policy, and so on. So he's basically, again, this, you know, wolf inside the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration was riddled with anti-Kennedy people. And so McCone's basically, as I say, continuing the Dulles policy, but you know, some of the darker stuff that the Dulles had initiated before McCone replaces him, I don't think McCone fully was even aware of. I think Helms, you know, and Angleton were running that. Dulles was, you know, they were probably keeping Dulles in the loop. But McCone, I think, you know, didn't want to know and was kept out of the loop. But so, yeah, the Dulles policy continued to go on even after Dulles left.
Well, specifically in the book, which, again, this is something. And by the way, let me add here, as the author just noted, you know, I had done a lot of work on Alan Dulles myself, but I really have to say there was a lot of things in this book that not only was I not aware of, but I was really surprised, you know, that David found it. Because this one I'm going to refer to now is in the book, you have him raising money through some business interests for a secret invasion of Cuba by the Cuban exiles in 1963? That's correct, isn't it?
Yeah. Is this, you mean Paulino Sierra Martinez are you referring to?
Yes, right.
Yeah, so he is this former Batista thug, basically. Some people, even in his family, thought he was an assassin, posed undercover for Batista, serving in some ministerial role for Batista that allowed him to go overseas. Batista, of course, is the mafia-connected, corrupt thug, is the best word for him, who ran Cuba before Fidel Castro. And so Paulina Sierra Martinez, you know, serves the Batista government, flees after Castro takes over, ends up in Florida with his family. He gets his law degree in the U.S. and ends up working for a Rockefeller-connected company in Chicago. Is it Union Tank Car? And starts raising money after the Bay of Pigs invasion when it looks like the anti-Castro movement has been cut off by the Kennedy administration. It's kind of at loose ends and is in something of disarray. Sierra Martinez comes into that vacuum at that point in late 62, I believe, and he starts to make connections to the mafia. He's making connections with U.S. corporations that have had a big stake in Cuba and had lost their assets after Castro took over. And he meets with Alan Dulles. And all we know is from the House Select Committee on Assassinations dug up this document that showed that he had met with Dulles. But here's a former CIA director who really moved in, you know, pretty high echelons, I mean, with the top people in corporate and political America. And suddenly he's meeting with this guy who was a former Batista hitman who's now raising money for an invasion, a new invasion of Cuba. So obviously this was not only in contravention of Kennedy policy at the time, who was withdrawing support more and more from the anti-Castro exile movement, but it was a bizarre sort of clash of two different social orders. You know, these weren't the kind of guys that Dulles normally hung out with. So that's kind of a mysterious meeting. Later, the Secret Service connects Sierra Martinez to a plot against JFK. And this, too, comes out during the House Select Committee investigation. And this is never fully explained, how he was involved in this plot and so on. The Secret Service wanted to pursue that investigation after Kennedy's assassination, but the FBI cut them off and said, basically, this is our investigation, you know, butt out.
Yeah, you made the connection to the Homer Echeverria incident, right?
Exactly. He was involved with Sierra Martinez was involved with him.
Yeah, which makes people well, I think you actually put it in your book. Is this part of the Chicago plot? Did you come to any conclusions on that?
I think that's what I believe that's what the Secret Service was on to, right? And of course we know that one of the more diligent people in the Secret Service, Abe Bolden, right, was working out of Chicago.
Right.
So that was the suspicion at the time, but the FBI shut down that investigation after Dallas. But again, it's just these are one of the many curious people that Alan Dulles is meeting with. So the book has been attacked here and there by people in the mainstream press for one said it was for being animated by conspiracy theories. But
we don't even have to go into that because I've read some of those and they are without merit and they're gutless and they're really so ill informed as to make them pointless.
They were unable to really engage with me in any detailed way because they are uninformed. Often these critics, they just are sort of mouthing what they've heard for years. And of course, it's a way of shutting down legitimate investigation into these dark corners of our history. But the point is, you know, everything in this book, it's a process of inductive reasoning, you know, to go back to Sherlock Holmes. Are there smoking guns that the CIA left around saying Alan Dulles was the mastermind of this? No, that's not the way they work. But once you enter a world that is this shadowy, the best you can do is to compile pieces of evidence and at the end come to an educated conclusion about all these hundreds and hundreds of pieces of evidence that I do put together in the book.
Oh, yeah. It's a very big book. Like I said, even just the audio version is 24 hours. But you leave this trail of meetings and insinuation where there's not going to be a paper trail if Dulles is meeting with Martinez there. Just the fact that they met and then you discover who the Sierra Martinez is and what he's been doing.
Well, and the other key assassin that you have to investigate in the context of Dulles is William Harvey. So we all know that name. You know, he's been a figure of great suspicion in the Kennedy case for many years, going back to the 70s. And basically, when you look at who was William Harvey? William Harvey was the guy that Dulles put in charge of the assassination operation that later was exposed by the Church Committee and other investigations in the 70s. This was the operation that targeted foreign leaders. And, of course, the CIA story at the time when it went before Congress to investigate it, to answer these charges in the 70s was, well, we were the gang that couldn't shoot straight. We tried to kill these guys like Lumumba and others, but, you know, we didn't really pull it off, and they ended up getting killed some other way. But the truth is they were much more effective than they let on. Lumumba indeed was killed by CIA contractors. And we don't know the full list of all the many people the CIA was killing in those years through the Cold War. We know that there was a death list after the Arbenz government was overthrown in Guatemala that included not just Arbenz, who did die under mysterious circumstances in exile, scalded to death in a bathtub in Mexico City. But we know that there were dozens and dozens of other people who are not even known to us, other opposition political leaders, journalists, union officials, farm worker organizers, many of whom ended up dead. And
well, yeah, you tell the story of Jose de Galinda.
That's on my list, too. This is the guy who wanted to expose Trujillo, right?
This is Jesus de Galinda, who was a Basque exile. He fled Franco after the war, ended up jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, ending up in the Dominican Republic during the Trujillo dictatorship, worked briefly for the Trujillo government, and then fled there to New York City and became a prominent critic of Trujillo, who ran probably one of the most vicious dictatorships of the era. And he became an academic at Columbia University and was getting his PhD there. And his PhD dissertation was a inside critique and indictment of the Trujillo regime. Trujillo got wind of this. He had his agents everywhere, and they tried to buy the thesis from him before he could complete it, but he refused. And one day after he had taught class at Columbia, he was headed back home to his apartment in Manhattan, and he was grabbed. And this, in one of the, I think, the first cases of CIA extraordinary rendition, he was grabbed by, again, CIA contractors working for Robert Mayhew, who was the detective who worked as a CIA cutout in the United States, because by law, the CIA was forbidden from operating on U.S. soil, so they used cutouts like Mayhew's detective agency. They grabbed this professor, got him out to Long Island, drugged him, put him on an airplane, flew him to Dominican Republic, where he was horribly tortured and executed by Trujillo's security people. So this is what later became known as extraordinary rendition, and it happened under Dulles.
And then another thing that you brought up, which, again, I'd been aware of, but you went into it a lot more depth than I've ever seen in the Kennedy research community, was a whole attempt of the CIA to encourage and help the OAS overthrow de Gaulle. And by the way, this is one of the things you've been criticized about, right?
Yeah, the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle criticized me for this because they said, well, my only sources were the French press at the time. Well, number one, there's no reason to suspect the French press was inaccurate, and this critic had no evidence that these reports in the French press were inaccurate. And number two, used other multiple sources for this, not just the reports in the French press at the time. And the reason those reports were in the French press was because the de Gaulle government itself was leaking to them. So here's an ally of ours, Charles de Gaulle, war hero, conservative, Catholic, not exactly, kind of the communist types, supposedly, that we were going around the world overthrowing. But he'd fallen into disfavor with the hardliners like Dulles in Washington because he was trying to settle the long, bloody colonial war, French colonial war, in Algeria. And he was also trying, he was very nationalistic and proud, and he was trying to steer his own direction and not be under the thumb of NATO. And so they resented this and decided that he had to go. So his efforts, de Gaulle's efforts to settle the war in Algeria, sets off a backlash from right-wing French generals there. And in April 1961, as poor JFK is still wrestling with the Bay of Pigs fiasco that the CIA has dumped in his lap, he's now forced to deal with another crisis instigated by the CIA when he starts getting outraged phone calls and howls of outrage from the de Gaulle government saying, what the hell is going on? Are you supporting this coup attempt against me? And they're expecting, troops from Algeria to begin descending in parachutes over Paris at any minute. There are tank units, rebellious tank units, gathering in force outside of Paris. It's one of the most dramatic moments in French, the history of French democracy in the 20th century. And so JFK is put in the very awkward position of saying, no, I have nothing to do with this coup, but I can't speak for my own CIA. So imagine that, the President of the United States telling a key ally, Charles de Gaulle in France, that I cannot speak for my own CIA, and that's what the French ambassador communicates back to Paris. De Gaulle is able, finally, by rallying the French people, it's a very dramatic thing, going on television, people pour into the streets, they basically face down this mutinous military action, and he wins the day. It's an amazing moment. And yes, it hasn't really been reported in this country, except at the time. What the Chronicle criticized me for this didn't mention is that even the New York Times was covering it at the time, James Reston in his column saying that the CIA has gone too far. They seem to be supporting this coup against, de Gaulle. So this was widely reported on at the time, and there was government documents I used also at the time, French and American, to support the fact that this was happening. De Gaulle, of course, after Kennedy's killed, later comes home from the funeral in Washington and tells his own information minister, well, Kennedy was killed by the same U.S. security forces that tried to kill me, which is a remarkable statement. And he goes on at length and he says, but the United States will never be able, official United States will never let this come out. It would cause rioting in the streets. It would, there'd be a civil war in the U.S. And so they'll never let this come out. And Oswald is a convenient fall guy. And it's fascinating, his observations and about this. As someone who's himself has been at war with his own right wing and with U.S. security forces and has been the target many times of assassination efforts, including the famous Day of the Jackal sniper attack on his motorcade very similar to Dallas in some ways, that he survives because his security team was loyal to him. So, you know, there's many interesting corners of history in the book.
When you started quoting that interview with de Gaulle, which I had never seen before, I'm reading this and I go, I wonder, was de Gaulle talking to Castro? Because it so much resembled what Castro said the day after the assassination. Yeah, you know, it was almost like they compared notes. This is what really happened. This is a bunch of BS what they're saying in the, you know, in the United States. You know, so you got this one conservative guy from Europe, and you got this communist guy in the Caribbean saying the same thing about what just happened 24 hours before.
Well, of course, the political elites all around the world said one thing for public consumption and then another thing among themselves. And de Gaulle is one case of this. Nixon was another case. I write about this more actually in Brothers, where LBJ, Nixon, de Gaulle, you know, Bobby Kennedy, they all immediately suspected a plot and they were convinced it was a plot. But of course, they all went along with the Warren Report as a convenient way to put the public's fears to rest. So, yeah, I mean, they all knew what happened. I mean, anyone who, like, particularly like a de Gaulle, who was very well aware of how security forces work and how they undermine democracies and how they often work with organized crime to do their dirty work. He knew it all, and he laid it all out for his information minister, who wrote about it in his memoir. And you're right. It was widely, of course, published. It was a bestseller in France, this information minister's book, his memoirs of working for de Gaulle. But it was the very briefest of quotes that hit the wires in the U.S. when this book was published, and that was it. So that's what all happens all too often. I don't speak French, but I worked with a French researcher who translated the book for me and other French sources. So it's amazing, even in the internet day, how sometimes, you know, these things, vital pieces of information like this, do get lost in translation.
I have a question here, though. You know, Victor Krulak had written to Fletcher Prouty identifying Ed Lansdale in Dealey Plaza. You have William Harvey in Dallas weeks before. Can you talk about this idea that the CIA has created this killing machine? And I think the observation that this whole task force aimed at Castro was turned around. And Dulles went in and met with these guys and said, we got new orders now.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I think even our own research community gets lost down these rabbit holes and we make things too complicated. But I think now 50 some years on, the best of our, you know, researchers and investigators can begin to agree on the big picture stuff. And to me, that's what I try to do with this book. I say, look, let's, you know, it's pretty obvious at this point. What happened was that the CIA under Allen Dulles did build a killing team. It built an assassination kill team that was used all around the world. And that kill team, in one form or another, came back, was brought back to Dallas to kill our own president. And it shouldn't be a surprise to people that, you know, when you create a beast like we did, this killing beast, and you put it in other people's backyards, to use an analogy that Hillary Clinton used in a different context not long ago, that beast is going to enter your own home at some point, which is what it did in Dallas. So what happened was this. We now know that Howard Hunt, by his own admission, was involved in that crime. His son is convinced of it on his deathbed. He basically made a veiled confession. We now know that David Morales, another key assassin for the CIA, was also by his own admission in Dallas. And now I put William Harvey, who maybe is the most important person to put in Dallas from the point of view of proving a conspiracy. As I was talking about earlier, William Harvey was, you know, a known thug and gun-loving head of the CIA's assassination operation, who was put in charge of that by Dulles. And he takes it over at some point early in the Kennedy administration, this operation that was inherited, you know, that was a holdover from the Eisenhower years, and that I believe that the Kennedys were unaware of at the time and had not authorized. In fact, when Bobby Kennedy finally told about May 62, he was outraged because, of course, he spent most of his life fighting the mafia, and suddenly he's being told by the CIA that they're working hand in glove to kill Castro. And he believed he'd stopped it at that point, but it did continue. In fact, at the very time that the CIA was telling Bobby Kennedy that they had pulled the plug on it, William Harvey was handing poison pills to his mafia friends to kill Castro. So Harvey is a very central figure because he's head of Allen Dulles' kill team. And when he finally falls afoul of the Kennedy brothers, they hate each other, And Harvey sends in a raiding team at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis that could have triggered World War III. When Bobby hears about this, he's so furious that Harvey's patrons at the CIA realize to save his career, they got to get him out of the U.S. and got to get him away from the Kennedys. So they send him to Rome, where he becomes station chief. And what the new information I have is from his deputy, Mark Wyatt, who was a career CIA official and a good one by all accounts, loved Italy, spoke Italian fluently. He and his wife had met there and married there. And if Harvey is sort of the ugly American, you know, a guy like Mark Wyatt is one of the decent ones. But he is working under Harvey, and he realizes this guy is dangerous. Among other things, Harvey's proposing to him that they recruit mobsters, mafia people in Italy, to kill Italian Communist Party officials. And Wyatt can't believe it. And they argue violently again and again. At one point, Harvey even draws a gun on Wyatt. Now, this is all from his, Wyatt is now dead, but from his grown children, three of whom I interviewed, all three of them, and from an investigative journalist named Fabrizio Calvi, who's a very respected investigative journalist in Europe, who interviewed Wyatt before he died at his retirement home in Lake Tahoe, who told him as he was leaving, you know, I've often wondered why Bill Harvey was in Dallas in November 63. Well, Calvi, this investigative journalist, knew enough about the Kennedy assassination to know that was an astounding thing, and so he asked him more about it. And apparently, Wyatt said he was on a plane going from Rome to Dallas in November 63, and he sees his boss, Harvey, there, and he asked him, why are you going to Dallas, Bill? And he was very vague, and he said, well, I'm just going to look around or something like that. So his own deputy, Bill Harvey's own deputy, told his children, his grown children, before he died, he was convinced that Bill Harvey was some way involved in the Kennedy assassination, not based just solely on that sighting, but on other things that Harvey told him in Rome. I believe that Harvey did play a key role there. That's what Howard Hunt said as well, that maybe he was the guy who was in charge of bringing in the killers or the guns. Who knows? But we now have his deputy placing him in Dallas in November 63. So this is another, I think, remarkable piece of evidence. So that's what I fundamentally believe. I believe that Dulles' kill team was brought home to kill our own president.
So let's just get it out on the record. You got Dulles in Dallas 3 or 4 weeks before the assassination. You got David Phillips in Dallas admitting this to his brother before he died.
And meeting with Oswald, according to Antonio Vecchiana, anti-Castro Cuban leader.
You got Hunt, and now you have Harvey. So what's the – were they all Cowboys?
And David fans? Morales.
Yeah. What were they all doing there? I mean, is it just a coincidence?
Very
strange.
Yeah. And by the way, I tried to nail this down further by petitioning the CIA through the Freedom of Information Act for Bill Harvey's travel vouchers to prove that he was actually in Dallas, and that he was flying from Rome to Dallas in November 63. And, of course, they stonewalled me and refused to release those records.
What was the grounds on which they refused to give them to you?
That they weren't relevant.
Are you serious?
Jim Lazar, who's, of course, the indefatigable, Washington attorney who's gone after the CIA again and again on behalf of many investigators, researchers, was my attorney on it. Yeah, and they either, run down the game clock, and so you have to go to press with your book before they get back to you, or they give some vague responses. And that's happened to me again and again. I've never been able to get anything out of the CIA.
If they would have said that to me in court, I think would have fallen down laughing. It's not relevant if Harvey was in Dallas before the assassination. Oh my God! Yeah, wow. Then the other thing, of course, you have in there, which I think is so fascinating, is that Dulles, on the night of the assassination, begins a 2-day sojourn at the farm. So why don't you explain what the farm is and why that's so odd that he would go there?
Yeah, the farm, which is also known as Camp Peary, is a high-security facility that is operated, I think, still to this day in Northern Virginia by the CIA. Dan Hardway, the House Select Committee, former investigator for the House Select Committee on Assassination, called it basically an alternative command post that Alan Dulles set up for himself. And he actually had a very comfortable, nice house built for himself right on the base. It was used, according to other CIA sources, including Philip Agee and others, as a training center for foreign operatives and an interrogation center for people who had fallen into CIA hands, even as an assassination training center. So very interesting, site for Alan Dulles suddenly to show up at the weekend that President Kennedy is killed in Dallas, and that Jack Ruby then kills Lee Harvey Oswald. A lot going on that weekend. And so here's a retired CIA official who supposedly has no professional connection to the U.S. government at that point. He's been fired by Kennedy 2 years before. He's supposedly retired. And yet he's not at home watching the events in Dallas like the rest of Americans. He's at a CIA facility. And he puts this in his own day calendar. He's there at the farm, as it was called, for that entire weekend. So, yeah, this is obviously a provocative piece of information. And, we don't know for certain, and probably never will, what he was doing there, but there he was.
And then you follow this up with another very, very fascinating tidbit that somehow, LBJ just didn't pull Alan Dulles' name out of space. Alan Dulles actually had a lobbying campaign to get on the Warren Commission.
Absolutely. Well, of course, the story that LBJ himself told that then other people picked up, including Robert Caro, who should know better, the historian who spent, volume after volume, detailing all the deceitful ways of Lyndon Johnson. And yet he takes this one at face value. And Lyndon Johnson wrote in his memoir, oh, yeah, Bobby Kennedy wanted me to appoint Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission. Well, to me, this is absurd for a number of reasons. One is that Lyndon Johnson would confer that closely with Bobby Kennedy about such a delicate issue as who he was going to put on the Warren Commission, an investigation that might have sealed his own fate. Bobby Kennedy, of course, and Lyndon Johnson were notorious political enemies. They despised one another. And so he's not going to be taking that kind of political advice from Bobby. Number two, the idea that Bobby would himself urge LBJ to take Dulles is also highly suspect. Again, Bobby kept a list of all the enemies and knew that Dulles was an archenemy of his brother. He'd been fired. In fact, it was Bobby who insisted that all Dulleses be cleansed, be purged from the Kennedy administration after the Bay of Pigs, including Alan's sister, Eleanor, who worked at the State Department. He went to Dean Rusk, Secretary of State, and said, get rid of all the Dulleses. So the idea that Bobby Kennedy, who said, get rid of all the Dulleses, is going to want Alan Dulles to serve on the investigation of his brother's murder, I mean, please. So, but this gets repeated endlessly. Now, Phil Shannon, the former New York Times reporter, we can talk about him later, what he's all about, repeated it recently in his article in Politico that's been causing a lot of controversy. So it's one of these endless, I think, CIA kind of tropes that gets repeated over and over again. Because, of course, if you have Bobby Kennedy, blessing Alan Dulles, then somehow, of course, this gives some legitimacy to the whole Warren investigation. No, it was, he strong-armed people. He had intermediaries go to LBJ, this is Dulles, to say he'd got to put Dulles on the commission. Richard Helms said this himself, his right-hand man at the CIA. I quote two or three sources on this, that Alan Dulles worked very hard behind the scenes to get Johnson
Corson,
to the point.
Corson.
Yeah, including Bill Corson, who was sort of a Marine guy who was connected to the CIA, who, was very close to the Dulles family. Corson himself said Dulles went all out, to get on that commission.
And then, of course, the capper is that once he gets on the commission, he becomes the single most active member of the Warren Commission because he was the only guy who didn't have a job.
Exactly. He didn't have a day job. So the senators and the congresspeople, right, are shuttling back and forth to the Capitol building doing their business all during the Warren investigation. Earl Warren himself is still sitting on the Supreme Court as Chief Justice, so he has a busy job. John McCloy was still employed elsewhere, the banker diplomat, but he had a little more time, and I think he and Dulles are the two most significant figures. If you read the minutes from those hearings, and followed closely by Jerry Ford, who I think was the FBI's man on the commission, who was a young congressman at the time. I think those three are the ones who really control, and you can see it from the very beginning, because the most important decision the Warren Commission makes early on is who's going to be chief counsel, because, of course, that's a very key sensitive post. the person who really is going to day-to-day run the investigation. And that turned out to be J. Lee Rankin, of course, who was, you know, someone who was closely associated with the Dulles wing of the Republican Party and someone that Dulles wanted in that post, while Earl Warren himself had wanted Warren Olney, who had served with him in the Eisenhower Justice Department and was someone he trusted. But those three, Ford, McCloy, and Dulles, joined forces to block Earl Warren's choice, and they installed their own instead.
Well, I was going to ask you, with this in-depth of research, how long did it take you when you started writing to get this book out?
Well, you know, in some ways it flowed from the brothers, which took about 4 years or even longer, 4 or 5 years, because I was starting from scratch there. With Dulles, I had sort of more of a head start because of my previous work on Brothers, but it took 3 years. And I also should give a shout out here to Karen Croft, who is my right-hand person on all my books and works with me closely on research on all the books. And there's no way I could have done it in 3 years without Karen's help. So it took us, 3 years, research and writing.
Because it sounds like you've traveled around the world for these interviews.
Well, we did. We went to... We had some interesting sources in Italy because I tell an interesting story there. And there's an investigative magistrate, Carlo Mastelloni, who's done some very important investigative work on sort of the deep state in Italy and the CIA. And Mastelloni had some important information for us about Alan Dulles and the CIA in Italy and how they tried to subvert Kennedy policy there. And, yeah, so we went far afield on this. But, of course, Joan Dulles, or Joan Talley is the married name, Dulles' daughter, was another interesting source. Siri Hari Angleton, James Angleton's daughter, both of whom live in New Mexico. We went down there and spent time with them. Often, you know, because virtually all these people are dead, of course, the main characters in the book, their children turn out to be sometimes interesting sources of information. And in Joan's case, she not only gave us interviews of great length, interviewed her many times, but also kind of turned us on to her mother's diaries and correspondence, which were very revealing, and also the correspondence and diaries of Mary Bancroft, who was not only her mother's friend, but Alan Dulles' mistress. So I think that, you know, from a personal point of view, was very important as well.
Yeah, you know, because we've heard a lot about John F. Kennedy having all these flings and that. And when you look at Alan Dulles, you think of this college professor or something, you know, it seems that he's even more of a flander than John F. Kennedy. I mean, do you want to comment on that, or what's your opinion?
Yeah, I think he was definitely, you know, thought of himself as a ladies' man. At one point, he was bragging to his mistress that he'd slept with 10 women. Maybe JFK could have outnumbered him on that one. And his mistress thought that was kind of a small number. But I found even more, actually, what was more to me telling about Alan Dulles was not, you know, his adulterous relationship, so much as the way he related to his own family. And Joan said, you know, that he had this kind of, the way she described him and his relationships to his own children was this guy who related to his children as they were guests somehow in his own house. He had this kind of, you know, cold detachment from everyone around him who was he was supposedly close to. On the surface, he could be very charming. You know, he was the life of the party and all that. But underneath was this kind of cold detachment, is the best way of putting it. And, you know, Karen, my colleague, you know, came to think that he was a psychopath, based on just, you know, many of the things that we saw him do in his personal life and political life.
Well, do I have this correct, that he was writing letters back to his wife bragging of flings that he had?
Yeah, I mean, he put his, I think, you know, Clover Dulles, his wife, was a very sensitive, artistic woman. She was not meant to be married to a man like Alan Dulles. She was unclear why she'd even fallen into his clutches. She could never explain, really, why she even married him. But he kind of laid siege to her and married her within, like, after 3 weeks or something after they got together. So she was always, I think, confused by him and finally said, very sadly, very painfully, in one of her diaries late in her life, you know, this man doesn't say anything to me. He never talks to me about anything, not just about his work, but about anything. And, you know, we know that he later tried to steer her into the hands of Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron, who was probably the most notorious figures in the MKUltra program, this mad scientist who ran the so-called sleep room experiments up at McGill University, where, you know, these poor unsuspecting patients, many of them just suffering from sort of garden variety nervous disorders, postpartum depression or whatever, mostly women, were put in the clutches of this mad scientist who was conducting mind control experimentation on behalf of the CIA. And it involved putting these people in these deep sleep states through overdoses of drugs where they would be played endless tape loops to try and erase their minds and replace bad thoughts with good thoughts. I mean, we're talking about really barbaric stuff. And Dulles at one point, you know, Clover Dulles, who was very distraught about the marriage, was put in touch with Cameron, and he wanted her to come up to Canada. And fortunately for her, she didn't. But their son, Alan Dulles Jr., who came back from the Korean War with a brain injury after sustaining a wound there, he unfortunately was put in the hands of an MKUltra scientist who subjected him to experimental insulin overdose therapy, which is a very brutal treatment that involves convulsions and in some cases, even death. You know, Joan witnessed this when she went to visit him in this New York hospital where Alan Jr. was put, and he was begging her to get him out of there, and she said it was a very traumatic experience.
Well, you called Alan the psychopath, and his wife and mistress had a nickname for him, the Shark.
That's right. That's what they called him, sort of affectionately, I guess, but it's very telling. Yeah, I mean, he was a shark. He was, you know, driving relentlessly forward, this cold guy who really saw people, and that's why I use the image of chessboard in the title. And it comes up again and again. You know, he talks about that, but he really, and his brother, I think, who loved playing chess against each other and kind of blocked out the whole world while they were playing chess, really saw the world as their chessboard, saw people as pawns. I found this really fascinating when I read his oral history. And imagine what kind of psychopath who, as I make the case for, and if you do believe this, that he was responsible for playing a central role in the assassination of Kennedy, and then sends condolence letters to the Kennedy family. That was chilling. After each Kennedy is killed, you know, he sends condolence letters after Bobby is killed to Teddy and so on, and after JFK to Bobby. But he then gave an interview to the JFK library, and he sits down with his friend, his buddy Tom Braden from the CIA for this oral history. And he's talking about, oh, yeah, JFK had lived. He might have been a great president, you know, and he puts on this mask of, you know, kind of grief. And then it always was a mask with Dulles. But then he's talking about the actual operation at the end of this interview. And you can't help but feel the excitement and satisfaction that he got from the operation of a lifetime. And you just, you know, you sense that, like, he would love to just brag about this thing. We pulled this off, because he loved ops. That was the thing that really turned on Alan Dulles. And the way he's talking about it in this Kennedy oral history is like, well, it was like the mechanism of a fine watch, that everything had to work just perfectly. And he talks about it like almost like a chess game. He, I think, uses that metaphor at one point. Every piece had to be moved properly for Kennedy to be killed that day and he's saying, of course, by Oswald. But I think he's really saying is by the CIA masterminds who put this thing together. So it's, you know, deeply creepy.
Well, you know, another thing, you talk about Dulles having this mask, a conversation which I was not aware of was, I think you mentioned secondary guy, subordinate, Dick Drain.
Yeah, who worked on the Bay of Pigs operation.
Right. Maybe you should just discuss that briefly. Dulles is out of the country, and he's flying back home, and here he's going to be briefed by someone who's going to tell him that all hell's broken loose, everything's gone wrong. And just give us a brief insight into that, because that's almost worth the book alone. Again, there's so many things that are just of interest and telltale of the Dulles mind.
Yeah, well, Dick Drain is like thunderstruck, as you say, because he picks Dulles up at the airport. He thinks Dulles is going to be eager to hear every detail about what's going on so he can, you know, Dulles can get back to President Kennedy and maybe urge him to take action or whatever it is. And yet he seems kind of sublimely indifferent. And he drives him back to his home in Georgetown, and Dulles invites him in for a drink, and he thinks, okay, now we're going to get down to business. And still, it's like, you know, he's asking Drain about other things, like, well, I'm supposed to go to the White House tomorrow to meet, you know, the president of Greece. You were in Greece, Dick, weren't you? You know, can you tell me a little bit about him? And so on. So just seems to be completely indifferent to this unfolding crisis in Cuba that's about to bring down his career. Well, here's what I think was going on with that. And I think this is indisputable at this point. I think the CIA knew, and Dulles knew, that this motley brigade of Cuban exiles was doomed to fail. These 1,100 guys were being landed on the beaches. They were being sent as cannon fodder to their deaths, to their doom, because what we know from the CIA's own internal reports on this that were done by Lyman Kirkpatrick, the inspector general after, and by CIA historian later, that Dulles had stocked the Cuban operation with the C-level guys, the worst guys in the CIA. That's what they were called in their own CIA internal reports. So Dulles had gone around saying, yeah, well, we're only going to have the best for this operation. But in fact, he put the losers in charge of that. And the people that should have been there, including one who had literally written the book Amphibian Operations on Landings, because he had experienced a lot himself during World War II in the Pacific, he was kept away from it. So the CIA veterans couldn't believe this. But I think the plan was it was supposed to fail and then, of course, force Kennedy's hand at the height of the crisis and force Kennedy into sending in the full power of the U.S. military to save this debacle. And Kennedy, of course, doesn't do that. He stands his ground. He never wanted to do this in the first place. He felt sandbagged that he had to do it to avoid a major political, you know, backlash if he pulled the plug on it since it had gone on so long. But he's not going to expand it into an all-out military operation, and he pulls the plug. So that's the astonishing thing to Dulles, that Plan B didn't work. Plan B was for Kennedy to be forced into sending in the Marines and the Air Force. But the actual operation that he had mounted was a loser operation and was meant to fail.
In the space of less than a year, because Dulles leaves in November of 61, you have Kennedy versus Dulles on Congo. Then you have Kennedy versus Dulles at the Bay of Pigs. And you have Kennedy versus Dulles with the OAS in France. And by the end of that, it's pretty much Kennedy realizes he made a mistake. He should have never let this guy on, never let him stay there. You know, and so then he essentially, him and his brother, with some help, I think from you state some help from Schlesinger, you know, they decide that Dulles has to go and that the CIA has to be reorganized. In fact, that was very interesting, the segment you had on Schlesinger. It's something I didn't know, that Kennedy had actually tasked Schlesinger with doing a reorganizing plan for the CIA.
Yeah, I was really interested to come across that, too. You know, I had told the story of how sorry, the Kennedy presidency had split in two in my book Brothers. And so I knew I needed to address that again in this book, but I didn't want to just repeat myself. So I was looking for a new narrative way to tell that story in a fresh way. And when I came across Schlesinger's, Arthur Schlesinger's journals, some of which were collected and published by his sons, but a lot of the material was not. And so the full journals are at the New York Public Library. And when I came across those, that was my sort of light bulb, because Schlesinger, I think, is a fascinating fly on the wall during the Kennedy presidency. On the one hand, he has one foot in the CIA world. He socializes with these guys. He's former OSS. He's buddies with Dick Helms and other CIA guys. They're part of the same Georgetown party circuit. On the other hand, of course, he is loyal to Kennedy. He's this new frontiersman, and he's kind of in the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and he advises Kennedy not to go ahead with the Bay of Pigs. So he's becoming more and more of a critic of the national security hardliners while he's serving in the Kennedy White House. And he happens to be a great writer. So he keeps these very meticulous daily diaries, which, as I say, are at the New York Public Library. So as I'm reading these day-to-day entries, you can see Schlesinger starting to break away more and more slowly from his CIA people and side more and more with the Kennedy White House and realized, you know, particularly at the Bay of Pigs, that this thing's out of control. The CIA is out of control. The Kennedy administration, if it's going to succeed and control its own foreign policy, needs to discipline this, you know, out-of-control agency and get control of it. So he makes a bid to Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs and says, hey, I know you want, you know, he famously said, Kennedy, I want to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter into the winds. So he was so mad. But Schlesinger says, look, put me in charge of this reform effort and I'll oversee the overhaul of the CIA. And he throws himself into it. And you see from his files at the Kennedy Library all his research that he's doing into the CIA. And he's interviewing people. He's gathering all this material. And, of course, because he is a liberal, I mean, a lot of his materials are from The Nation magazine. They're from The New Republic. They're from critics on the left of the CIA. And his final sort of proposal is this detailed proposal for what to do with the CIA, and it's pretty extensive. Number one, he wants to take the name CIA off this agency because he thinks it's been so tarnished. It's a bad brand. He wants to break it up into different components. He wants to put it much more firmly under the control of the White House and the State Department. So he basically wants to take this rogue agency that Harry Truman himself, who created it, and others are now worried is become this out-of-control force in American life, and break it into different pieces and really put it firmly under Democratic control. And he presents this to Kennedy, and, of course, there's major pushback from the agency and from people like Maxwell Taylor, who's, you know, has now become a military advisor to Kennedy in the White House, and from the whole sort of national security wing. And, you know, Schlesinger's efforts are defeated. But that's a really interesting story about this internal sort of upheaval that's going on within the Kennedy presidency after the Bay of Pigs.
Did Schlesinger have sort of he seemed to me that he was really unable to handle looking at the facts of the assassination. And I think that's a real letdown. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, you know, I think Arthur Schlesinger is a fascinating guy, and I do try and tell his story because he was a really bright guy, and he knew intellectually, he knew in his head what had happened. He told me, I interviewed
him twice.
Well, but see,
okay, good, but you're making a case for him. And as I read, I mean, it's like people are clinging to every word he says, saying, see, you can never be sure. But if you take the idea that he knew and he couldn't handle it.
He knew and he couldn't handle it. That's exactly right. I think he knew there was a conspiracy. I think he basically said this to people, but he then, for public consumption, he would phrase it this way. He said, I'm an agnostic when it comes to the question of a conspiracy. So it's a coward's way out. Because he knew if he were to come right out and say, look, obviously this is a conspiracy and it was, you know, it came out of the CIA and the Pentagon, all the party invitations on the Georgetown circuit would dry up. He would be persona non grata in all the worlds that mattered to him, the New York and Washington and Boston chattering classes.
Yeah, but, you know, he was anyway. He was just, you go into that in the book where he goes in one day and Johnson doesn't have anything for him to do.
Well, but that's different. So, yes, he immediately is iced out by LBJ because LBJ knows that he's a Kennedy guy and that he doesn't want this Kennedy intellectual hanging around the White House. So LBJ isolates him right away, and you know, Schlesinger gets the message, and he resigns. He's one of the first Kennedy guys to leave the Johnson administration. But that's different from the sort of circles that meant everything to Schlesinger. I'm talking about the Harvard-Cambridge circles. I'm talking about the New York media circles and party scene. I'm talking about the Washington power scene, you know. And he desperately wanted to remain part of those worlds. And so he intellectually knew that Kennedy had been killed by a conspiracy, but he couldn't go all the way and publicly say that. So that's why on his deathbed, he tells his son, who tells me this, that he says, Dad, do you have any regrets about anything you didn't write? Is there a book that you would have liked to write that you didn't? He goes, yes, I should have written a book about the CIA because it undermined our democracy. Well, he's clearly saying that at that point, you know, in his life as he's dying. And, you know, he couldn't bring himself all the way to confront the CIA, which I knew, but I strongly suspect he felt was behind the murder of the president.
If he would have done what Len is saying he should have done, he probably justified it in his own mind. The New York Times would have never asked me to review John Newman's book on the cover of their book review thing. And he actually gave it a pretty good review.
Mm-hmm. I think he walked a line, you know. He also endorsed, in a way, Anthony Summers' book, didn't he? I think he gave him a blurb, too, on his book Conspiracy.
Yeah, I think he did. I think you're right about that, yes.
And he met with Oliver Stone, you know, and Oliver was getting all this heat after JFK came out. But, of course, then in his diaries, he kind of dismisses Stone, too. But at least he was talking to these people, the researchers who were doing the best work. And he was keeping an open mind, and I think he knew they were right. but he himself didn't have the courage to go all the way and write something that could have actually, at least within those intellectual and liberal circles where he still was a important voice, it could have had an impact.
Well, I'm harder on him than you were. I think you're making a case for him.
Oh, I thought I was pretty hard on him, but maybe, you know, I could have gone after him more.
No, you don't have to.
I basically call him a coward, and that's what I think he was. He was an intellectual coward.
Yeah. No, that you're in the ballpark now. That's good, because so many people on the other side of the, you know, the lone assassin side, well, you know, who would have talked? Look at Schlesinger. And you know, and then when people, you know, talk down about a movie, about Oliver Stone's movie, I mean, you're getting into the Jim Garrison story, really. There's someone who tried to do something, and that's courage there, Jim Garrison. You know,
People love to bash Oliver because that somehow proved that they were, like, you know, much more hard-headed and, you know, and grounded in fact, which is bull. It's like they went after Oliver because they were cowards themselves. And Oliver was opening the doors to, you know, all these skeletons that they found deeply disturbing.
Well, he's exposing cowards in the media.
And he's exposing the cowards who didn't do their job at the same time. Right. I mean, look, the American media, you know, I have to say, after a lifetime in it, and after writing these two books on the Kennedy story, I just have complete contempt for it. I mean, it's all I can do to even talk to some of these reporters who call me up. Because either they're completely stupid and they have done no work themselves and they're lazy and ignorant, or they're, you know, they have some agenda. They're, you know, they're an asset in some way or another for the agencies who want to keep covering this up. So, you know, the American media, I mean, whenever they do stumble on a big story, it's usually they're stumbling on it or it's being leaked to them, and then they give each other awards and pat each other on the back. But whenever there is some kind of breakthrough, usually investigative breakthrough, it's as a result of an internal government conflict that leaks into the media. So, I mean, you know, the amount of true enterprise reporting, investigative reporting that's courageous and original, you know, you can count on one hand those stories in probably our whole lifetime.
Yeah. Now, I have one other question just to elaborate on this. So, do you think that there can be a part two to this? Do you think that there's enough meat here for researchers to continue this trail of Alan Dulles being behind the assassination?
Well, you know, I'm still a believer that CIA is sitting on those documents, those 1,100-some documents that they're withholding, that Jeff Morley's been going after for years. They're sitting on those for a reason. So, yeah, I mean, I think if we ever pry those loose or someone leaks them, we need Ned Snowden, frankly. I mean, you know, those documents, I guess, are sitting in NARA, in the archives. Someone could leak them. And, you know, I publicly call on someone, a conscientious person who works in the archives, to leak them, because that would be abiding by the federal law. The CIA is now obstructing justice. They're obstructing the JFK Records Act. So I call on government officials who have access to those documents to release them under law, under federal law. So, yeah, if we get our hands on those, that probably will shed some new lights. Maybe we'll see what William Harvey's, where he was traveling in November 63 for sure, and things like that.
Right, because you mentioned the media. I think in the book or in an interview, you talked about Don Hewitt of 60 Minutes going into this, and then they decided to drop the whole thing because they got orders from upstairs that we're not going to cover this story, even though there's a lot of, well, can you just elaborate on that? Is that in the book, or was did
well,
you?
That, yeah, that was in Brothers. But again, that speaks to what I was saying earlier. The elites knew the truth. The elites, the ones who were plugged in and had, you know, half a brain, could figure this out really quickly. There was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy. It was just too absurd, the whole thing. This guy who couldn't shoot straight with a bad gun, you know, pulls off the marksmanship feat of the century, you know, and then has quickly silenced himself by some mafia errand boy. I mean, it was all just absurd. And anyone, you know, could just see that. The American people saw it instinctually right away. So the elites were all telling each other this. Yeah, it was a conspiracy. Don Hewitt, when I interview him, one of the top investigative names in American journalism, the creator of 60 Minutes, basically said, yeah, I knew it was a conspiracy and probably was involved CIA guys and mafia and, you know, Cuban exiles. That's what he told me. It's in Brothers. I said, well, why didn't you pursue it? Why didn't you break the case? He goes, oh, well, we never could find enough. You know, that's the, you know, again, they always excuses for why they didn't do their jobs. Ben Bradley, I sat down with, probably who was the closest person in the Washington press corps to President Kennedy, frequent guest, he and his wife at the White House. They were pals, and he wrote a whole book about this, right, how good buddies they were. Well, I said, why don't you, like, try to solve your good buddy's murder? You know, I sat down with Ben at the Washington Post, where he still had an office after he retired as executive editor. And at least he had the guts or the honesty or whatever to tell me basically the truth. He goes, well, it probably would end in my career because people knew I was close to JFK and they would have thought I was obsessive and this and that. And that's probably true. It would have ended his career. But he, I'm sure, knew, could put two and two together, and he knew probably generally what had happened. But the Washington Post, again, massive failure. And even they, you know, because the Post usually goes behind government investigations. That's how they get really brave. And people start leaking during these investigations. They had the opportunity of a lifetime during the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the Church Committee to go behind those government investigations and do their own original work. Instead, they sort of, you know, they play the opposite role often, the New York Times and Washington Post. They criticize the investigations. They make trouble for the members of Congress who were involved in them. They undermine them. So it's cowardice. I mean, and at least Bradley had the honesty to admit it.
Getting back to Len's point about Schlesinger. See, Len, you tried to compare Schlesinger with Garrison. But what people leave out is that Garrison's career was destroyed.
I didn't try to compare him. I just said that Garrison was courageous and Schlesinger, upon my reflection, is gutless.
Well, but that's a very big decision to make. I mean, do I want to burn the rest of my career like this Jim Garrison guy who almost went to jail?
Well, what kind of career is it then?
Well, most people, I think what David's saying is that most people compromise their way out of it somehow, or they rationalize their way out of it somehow.
Yeah, but then
how many people do you know who are successful people self-immolate that way? I mean, it rarely happens.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I won't say what I'm thinking right now, but in that case, we have to commend David for writing about this.
Because self-immolating.
Okay, I didn't want to say it. You did. Because I've heard, you know, researching this, some of the other interviews you've done on, and frankly, one host and a couple of people who called in. I mean, it's pathetic. This is almost an orchestrated effort to discredit some of your work, because the people who come up with these criticisms, in order to get this far into the case to name the things they're talking about, you have to have done research. And it just defies all logic to think someone can, you know, some of the questions you've had to face on other shows. I mean, it's you know.
Well,
so
I think what happened, the way that the CIA, and let's call it like it is. The CIA still, I think, runs a disinformation machine, and I still think they have an interest in the Kennedy case. They certainly did, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and so on. But I still think, you know, there's that machine is still in operation. I think what happened with Brothers is that the Bugliosi book, which was subsidized, I believe, there's no way that a publisher publishes over 1,000 pages like that without losing money. So I think that was a subsidized operation. Bugliosi had assistants writing it and putting it together. And I was told by my own publisher, Simon Schuster, that Bugliosi's book was actually, the pub date was changed to go right up against mine. So someone made that decision. It was a political decision. So what I faced then when I went out anywhere on the media circuit when Brothers came out was this pit bull, you know, prosecutor who was in my face and distracting attention. And that was the way they counter-programmed me. It's counter-programming. It's the way they operate. The other thing is Hollywood is very important to them. It's more important than books. And so the only reason I think they're really concerned about books is because they can trigger Hollywood films or TV series. And so I tell the story in Salon Magazine, what happened, salon.com, what happened to me with Brothers in Hollywood. And, you know, what happened there was Lionsgate optioned it. They had it all set up to go. John Hamm at one point was going to play. He was very hot because Mad Men was really big. And it was their show. So they thought they had a great opportunity to set this up as a TV miniseries. And every network, even networks that initially were very excited, suddenly pulled the plug on it. And instead, what you had was Bugliosi's book, of course, that got optioned by Tom Hanks' production company. And I guess it eventually went through different iterations, but it turned into Parkland, right, Jim?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what how they play that game. They are very well connected. The CIA has its own. I'm in fact putting out a book under my imprint, Hot Books, by Nick Scow, who wrote Kill the Messenger, about the CIA's continued manipulation of media in Hollywood. They have a very active office in Hollywood to control their image. And so now it's the same thing. There was a huge interest in Devil's Chessboard in Hollywood when it initially hit. It's a great epic story. And, of course, Hollywood's now fascinated by the dark side of power with series like House of Cards and the Game of Thrones and so on. So it was right up their alley. And, you know, we see with Spielberg's new movie, the Cold War, espionage is hot and all that. So it was a natural. George Clooney demanded a copy of the book, the first copy, hot off, you know, the advance copy, the galleys. His agent drove it over to his house personally one weekend. And then when he realized what part three was all about, saying that, you know, Dulles was behind the assassination of the president, he flipped out because he knew that was, that he knows that's a career ruiner. Same with other big names. Kevin Spacey looked at it, Brad Pitt, on and on. They all turned it down because I think it's the third rail for them. They don't want to be Oliver Stoned. Oliver Stone himself, who's become a friend over the last few years, you know, told me, David, they'll never make these books into a movie or a TV thing. And I think Oliver's correct. So that's the way they operate. They have their own rival projects. Those are the ones that get out. They also respond to books like mine by selectively leaking documents that supposedly are, you know, are hot stories and that distract the media. And so they did that by selectively leaking, you know, this internal parts of this internal CIA biography of John McCone that Phil Shannon and his credulity, former New York Times guy, ran with as the hottest story in the world. Well, I was all set up to be excerpted or to write a piece based on my book for Politico. In fact, one of the key people at Politico loved the book and called it a masterpiece. That was his words. In an email to me, and it was all set up. And then at the last minute, the editor there pulled the plug on my book and said, no, we're going to run this Phil Shannon thing instead. You know, I was set up to, be interviewed on Al Jazeera America, even pulled the plug on me at the last minute. I was literally in a car in Manhattan on the way to the studio to be interviewed. And my publicist got a phone call and said, no, it's been canceled. And he was stunned. And he said, what do you mean? And he emailed the producer at Al Jazeera. And he got a one-word reply back, and that word was politics.
Wow.
So,
what a revelation.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's a war. It's a war of ideas. I'm not demoralized by this. I'm Irish. I love a fight. I know it's a fight, right? And it's fighting, as Ishmael Reed once said. And, you know, we're people like you and me, we're in a war. And we're losing the war, frankly. I mean, ever since JFK, since Oliver, you know, sort of turned the tide briefly, I hope that Devil's Chessboard sort of further emboldens our side and we take, you know, sort of the momentum back a little bit. I have a saying that the best story in the war of ideas wins. So I put a lot of effort into the way I wrote this book. So it would be a gripping read. It can be sort of positioned as a great spy epic because it is in a way.
Well, it's a history lesson as well.
Yeah, as well as a history lesson. But, I mean, I want to affect public opinion. And so, you know, I am being blocked by the media gatekeepers here and there. But they can't stop everything. It's like water through the cracks of stones. There is an alternative media, thank God, still. There are programs like yours, Len. There's, you know, Salon. There's Mother Jones. There's Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman. There's local radio. You know, local radio has been amazing. And shows like Coast to Coast, you know, that go across the country nationally or Pacific.
Oh, my God. I heard that Coast to Coast one.
One thing that I thought was very fascinating. If you follow the story, you have Dulles in Bern sort of beginning the Cold War. Then he comes back and the book has a very, very fascinating chapter on Dulles, Nixon, and Alger Hiss.
Right.
Okay. And it's sort of the way you depict it, sort of like the Dulles brothers were the guys in the back room, both encouraging and manipulating Nixon in his pursuit of Alger Hiss.
That is accurate. I think that's a really important and fascinating transitional period in American history because you have this really critical transition from FDR's Washington and the New Deal era to, you know, the Dulles and Eisenhower era, with sort of Truman being this transitional presidency in between. And what was happening there was a political war over the future of the country. As I say, if Roosevelt and the New Deal, say Henry Wallace, had been, you know, sort of had continued the Roosevelt era, it would have been so vastly different. There may not have been a Cold War. Certain people, like the Dulles brothers, might have even been brought to justice. There would have been a public accounting of what had happened, the collaboration with the Nazis and so on. But the Dulles brothers and that wing of the Republican Party were brilliant, and they realized that the anti-communist witch hunt and that fervor that they were ginning up and generating after the war, you know, basically saying the New Deal was riddled with communist spies, which was absurd. You know, that was their weapon that they used to purge Washington of those elements that were threats to them. And it was hugely effective. And of course, you know, of course, Stalin and the Soviet Union played into their hands as well. Paranoid, you know, despot in the Soviet Union, I'm not saying was all sort of a creation of Dulles, the Cold War. But he certainly, that wing of the Republican Party certainly exploited it in a masterful way. And one of the people that they do create and impose on America, I believe, is Richard Nixon. He is a creation of the sort of Dulles Dewey wing of the Republican Party. They sponsored his first run against Jerry Boris. And Jerry Boris was, you know, a young congressman from Southern California who was sort of one of the leading symbols in Congress of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. He'd been a socialist and a union activist and had some very radical, innovative ideas about what to do with the American economy and how to extend Social Security as a sort of a social safety net. And he wanted to nationalize the banks, and he wanted to go after the oil industry, and he was their worst nightmare, you know, Republican corporate America's worst nightmare. So he was a target in any case, and they were able to get two birds with one stone by running this young Dick Nixon against Boris, knocking the New Dealer out, and then Nixon becomes their weapon, this, you know, this witch-hunting weapon who begins to purge Washington as a whole of the New Deal legacy.
And it, of course, historically speaking, it was really Nixon's pursuit of Alger Kiss and his success in getting him indicted and convicted that really encouraged McCarthy. So
yes,
this really began the whole Red Scare too, the second Red Scare.
Absolutely. It just takes off from there. And then McCarthy, of course, becomes his own Frankenstein, and even threatens Eisenhower and Dulles, and then he has to be dealt with. And we always think, oh, it was the Army-McCarthy hearings that finally brought down McCarthy, which is true. But the person who drew first blood was Joe McCarthy, who really went after him at first and started to defeat him, was Alan Dulles. And I tell that story in the book.
Yeah, because this is ironic. It's because Dulles won't turn over Bill Bundy, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, he keeps coming after every department institution in Washington. You know, his brother Foster caves under the McCarthy assault and gives McCarthy basically everything he wants and purges the State Department of just about every, you know, its best and brightest, basically. And then he comes after the CIA, and Alan says, no, that ain't going to happen. I control the CIA, you know, off. And McCarthy rages and throws a tantrum, but Alan Dulles basically backs him down. And I think, you know, there was hardball played there, because I think, you know, they had compiled a lot of dirt on McCarthy by then, his sexual proclivities and all of that, and they were prepared to do whatever they needed to do to defeat him. This is the CIA. So it was Alan Dulles who began the downfall of Joe McCarthy.
All right, that's it for me, Len.
Okay,
thank
good.
You.
Well, I've got two last questions, and one I was going to ask, what was the most surprising fact about Alan Dulles that you discovered?
That's too big, Len.
There wasn't one that was just too surprising?
I think we talked about so many of them. I can't pinpoint just one. You know.
Okay, fine. Yeah. My last question then was just maybe a brief comment about, you know, when Truman wrote about that Frankenstein article, you discussed a little bit how Dulles actually changed the record. And I think you alluded to it earlier, but this is the fact. If he couldn't get his way, he would just go back and report something different. I mean, he met with Truman, and Truman wouldn't back down from the article, correct?
Right. Well, you see, this is the way that intelligence, you know, agencies often operate. I mean, basically John Newman has written a whole book, at least one book or more now, I guess, on how they did it with Oswald. You create a legend. You create a documentary record about something in order to alter reality itself. And so Oswald becomes one thing in the files and something else in real life. So, yeah, what happened was Truman writes this bombshell of an op-ed in the Washington Post during the very emotionally fraught days right after Kennedy's assassinated. And there it is in bold print in the Washington Post. The former president of the United States who created the CIA, Harry Truman, is writing that the CIA is out of control and that not only is it threatening democracy overseas, but a democracy at home. And what are people to make of this in the days right after Kennedy's killed? So Alan Dulles flies into action. He tries to get Clark Clifford, who's a Washington power broker, who's close to Harry Truman, to lean on Truman to get him to retract the piece, but that doesn't succeed. Truman, of course, is famously stubborn. So Dulles flies down to Independence, Missouri himself to meet with Truman. And again, you know, wheedles and pressures him and tries to get him to take back this piece, saying, look, it was you who created the CIA. You certainly wanted it to be an aggressive thing, but Harry Truman will have none of it. You know, he stands by his piece. So he comes home, Dulles, to Washington. And what does he do? He writes a letter to the general counsel, Lawrence Houston of the CIA, and says, you know what, I talked to Harry Truman, and it seems like he really didn't know what he was writing, or it was written by somebody else, one of his aides, and, you know, presents this picture of Truman as if he's the senile guy who has been either manipulated somehow or didn't even know or think through the consequences of what he was writing. And that goes into the CIA files, and you can still see when you sort of, you know, Google this and look into this online, that there's then this, it takes on a life of its own. It becomes the CIA official version of what happened. Oh, yeah, Harry Truman was manipulated somehow, and he didn't really mean to write this. And so that's out there now. Dulles was the guy who set that in motion.
But Truman reaffirmed what he thought in his letter to Look magazine, right?
He did. He reaffirmed at least twice that I referred to. One was in a letter to Look, and one was to the former CIA director.
Sowers.
Yeah, who had congratulated Harry Truman on this op-ed piece, and Truman writes back saying, yes, you know what I was saying was correct, because that was what we intended the CIA to be, just an intelligence gathering agency and not this kind of covert action rogue agency that's going around the world doing all these sinister things. So, yeah, I mean, clearly he intended to write it. He stuck by it, and he continued to stick by it despite what Dulles was saying.
Well, the thing that impressed me about that incident, that if Alan Dulles was retired, why would he have to fly out there to do this? And, I mean, he's still behind pulling all the strings.
Yeah, he's still the main advocate. He's still the guy who's the godfather of that agency.
Right.
And he's the old man. In other words, he's the affectionate god, you know, as he's affectionately referred to by the CIA old boy network. He's the guy that they all look to. And so this is, I'll leave you with just this final thing. This essentially is what I came to conclude, that I do believe to a certain extent in the great man theory of government. Dulles didn't operate on his own. It wasn't. I'm not trying to say, like some people have said, that he's this, somehow this evil Superman. He operated within a system of power, and that's why I write about C. Wright Mills, the great sociologist who wrote The Power Elite. C. Wright Mills was onto this at the time. He was analyzing Dulles' people within this as members of a system of power that included key security officials, included corporate figures, included people on Wall Street. So Dulles only operated, I think, on major issues when he felt there was a consensus within the circle. But at the same time, I've now, at this point in my life, after running a company myself, after dealing with business people and being in the political world, and seeing, frankly, how history was changed with the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, I've come to appreciate how individual leaders who have unique abilities and unique connections and are uniquely persuasive can actually affect history in a major way. And Alan Dulles was one of those people. He was someone who was uniquely connected throughout those power circles. He was connected in the Wall Street world, and he was connected in the corporate world. He was connected in the national security world. He was connected to overseas interests. And he was like Dick Cheney on steroids. And so when he came forward and said, look, this president has to be removed for the good of the country, He's an aberrant president. He's a weak president. He's putting the country at risk. He was one of the guys who could develop one of, maybe the only political figure at that time who did have the connections, the gravitas, the stature within that power elite to make something like this happen. And so there's no other person, I think, who fits that kind of criteria. And again, I'm not saying he acted on his own. I'm saying that he was a very key central figure within this power network. And when he finally made the decision, the old man will take care of it, as the Russian priest said at the party where Peter Dale Scott was, that, you know, instilled confidence in everyone. And for CIA officials and operatives to know that the old man was behind this, that gave them the blessing that they needed.
Now we continue with the following piece. Thanks to Tony Gosling from BCFM for this. He's interviewing author Adam Labore about his then new book on the BIS. This is from June 2013.
Adam Labore's book, The Tower of Basel, has just been published, and it makes for frightening reading. The bank provided a lifeline to Hitler in the 1930s, helping fund his arms build-up, and through the war was providing the Nazis with much-needed foreign exchange. Well, I spoke to Adam about the new governor of the Bank of England and his secretive employer earlier this week.
My name is Adam Labore. I'm an author and a journalist. I've written a book called Tower of Basel, the shadowy history of the secret bank that runs the world, and it's the first investigative history of the Bank for International Settlements. The BIS is a really fascinating institution, and in one line, it's the most important bank in the world that you've almost certainly never heard of. And I'm interested in how power is exercised in the world and the role of international institutions. I've previously written a book about the UN and its failure to confront or deal with genocide. The BIS grew out of the same kind of era, in a way, as the United Nations. The BIS was founded in 1930, ostensibly as a means to manage German reparations payments for the First World War, i.e. the financial penalties imposed on Germany for the First World War. But the real reason the BIS was founded was to have a place where central bankers could meet outside the supervision politicians and away from nosy journalists. The BIS was founded by an international treaty, which means that it's similar to the United Nations or a foreign embassy. It's technically extraterritorial in Switzerland. The Swiss authorities, although it's based in Basel, the Swiss authorities need the permission of the bank's management to enter the bank, and its assets can never be seized, even during times of war. It can't really be sued under any international Swiss law, and the management enjoy a number of similar privileges to diplomats.
The Swiss authorities, if they need to have permission to actually even enter the premises, then that isn't really a part of Switzerland, Adam.
No, it's not. I mean, and I tried quite hard to find out the exact legal niceties of this, but the bank wasn't particularly helpful. But as far as I could see, I mean, they did send me a copy of the treaty that founded the bank and the 1987 agreement with Switzerland. But as far as I could see from reading it, it means that, yes, technically, it's the same as an embassy or the United Nations. It's legally an international body. But it's also a commercial bank, and it only has 140 customers, mostly their other central banks, and it makes the profits tax-free. It was founded in the 1930s at a time when the League of Nations was active, when there was this sort of idealism that, you know, nationalism had led the world to the horrors of the First World War. So transnationalism and supranational institutions were really the way forward.
One of the things I found fascinating looking at this bank was that for many years it was very anonymous. After the Second World War, it seems there was a certain amount of embarrassment, and that they were actually, even though they were one of the most powerful banks in the world, based with an anonymous door, and the bank was based over the top of a chocolate shop opposite Basel Station.
I mean, the bank was very anonymous before World War II. The idea, you know, this was a different age when the elites and governments and powerful people weren't really interested in being accountable. But something of that spirit still continues. I mean, nowadays, every 2 months, the 60 big central bankers of the world meet there, people like Ben Bernanke from the Federal Reserve and Mervyn King and his successor Mark Carney to discuss the global economy, and someone who's been to one of those meetings
gave me a great quote. He said the main topic of conversation in those meetings was the stupidity of finance ministers and the quality of the wine. So you can see that that very elitist approach continues.
Now, you said that there are 60 banks, central banks, that sort of go there and meet, but there are 120 customers. Can you give us an idea of who those customers are?
The bank doesn't say who its customers are, and this is a big contradiction. I mean, we can guess that they're mostly central banks. I think most of the central banks of the world have an account there, probably some international organisations as well. I would believe that the International Committee of the Red Cross does as well, because I found some documents in the BIS archives showing that they had dealings with the ICRC during the Second World War. But, and this is the problem, you see, because the BIS says it's an international institution with a mission of public service. Well then, who are your customers? What are you doing for them? But central banks are not commercial organisations. They're managing public reserves. And this is why the secrecy that surrounds the BIS is so problematic. Because when the bankers meet there every 2 months, there's nothing released, there's no press release, there's no agenda, there's no minutes or anything of the discussions. Even though the people that go there are public servants, we're paying their salaries and their plane tickets and their pensions. And yes, we need some more information about what's going on at this bank and what the kind of discussions are taking place there. It's a meeting place for the central bankers. And during the crisis, it's been a very important meeting place. I had an interesting interview with Sir Mervyn King, and he said that, you know, this is a place where they've been able to discuss the different policies and the different mechanisms by which they can deal with the crisis. And so the BIS is more a kind of forum for that and doesn't have an actual management role. And I give it some credit. During the mid-2000s, the BIS was one of the few organizations that was actually warning and saying, look, guys, there's too much money sloshing around here, and it's all going to end rather badly. So their predictions have come true. But I think the point is that we need to know much more about these discussions and what and who's there and what they're talking about, because these are public servants. And so it's a contradiction to have the confidentiality of a commercial bank but the privileges of an international organisation. I think you're either one or the other. I mean, this is one of the strange things about the BIS, is that it really operates under the radar. Now, we'll give it credit. It has a website, and on the website you can get the annual report, and it does have some information about how it works. But journalists don't seem to have picked up on it, and I think you're completely right, because Mark Carney's been a pivotal figure at the BIS. He's a former member of the Board of Directors. He's a chairman of the Financial Stability Board. Now, what's the Financial Stability Board, which most people have never heard of, is actually a very crucial, comparatively new international organisation. And it aims to coordinate regulatory and supervisory bodies for central banks around the world, in other words, to try and, you know, avoid the kind of mess that we've got now. And Mr. Carney was also chairman of the Committee on the Global Financial System, another thing which most people have never heard of, with is hosted at the BIS and issues policy recommendations to central banks. So Mr. Khan is clearly a very important person, and his CV in these areas, I think, is actually much more interesting than his record as governor of the Bank of Canada, because this is a good way to go in to say, you know, well, what are these organisations? What's their mandate? How do they work? What kind of thing does there?
Financial stability has not been happening, and the policy reacting to the problems with the financial crisis in 2008, which they've been developing at BIS, which Mark has been developing, neither does that seem to have really been working.
Well, I think you're highlighting an important issue here. I mean, where does the power of central banks come from? Now, obviously, in a democracy, you can't have the government telling the central banks what to do all the time, you know, boost money supply, cut money supply, you know, because they could, for example, engineer a mini boom just before an election by playing around with the money supply, and central banks have to have some degree of independence. But on the other hand, I think we need to know much more about how they're operating. And central banks themselves are more transparent than the BIS. You know, they do, Bank of England does release some minutes of its discussions, so does the Federal Reserve. But it seems like when they get to the BIS, it's the door shut behind them, they've got all these legal immunities around them, and they're suddenly on kind of protected international territory, and we don't know what's going on there, and we should.
What about the assets of the bank? Do we know how wealthy it is?
Yes, it's extremely wealthy. I mean, its profits for last year were more than $1 billion a year, tax-free. Those are distributed some in dividends, some go back into the bank. So it's regarded as one of the greatest places to do business with. It does provide a service as well. Say, if you're the governor of the Central Bank of Botswana, Estonia, you're unlikely to have the level of skills in asset management and liquidity supply that they can offer you at the BIS. So it provides a service to these banks, and it has a lot of gold. The most recent statistics I had showed that it had around 119 tons of gold, which makes it the 30th largest holder, around the 30th largest gold holder of gold reserves in the world, but more gold than Qatar or Canada. And it's a very, very rich institution.
At what point did money stop serving the populations and the people, and at what point did it turn around where people started serving the money system?
I think it's an interesting question. I mean, I don't think there's any one kind of day when that happened, but I think if we talk about Britain, I think clearly there was a big shift in the Thatcher era and the immediate post-Thatcher era, and it's perhaps related to the Big Bang as well, where the acquisition of money and the glorification of financial services happened, and which led in part to the wild housing boom that's going on, and the fact that it's a good point you raise. I mean, the fact is, if you're a university student now and say you want to become a teacher, unless your parents got the bank of mummy and daddy, you're extremely difficult for you to ever be able to own your own house. And I think a part of that is related to the amount of money. There just seems to be so much more money sloshing around the world.
It was decided at Bretton Woods to close the bank down. Why was that?
Because it was seen as something that was helping the Nazis, as indeed it was. The BIS accepted looted Nazi gold, and the BIS did foreign exchange deals for the Reichsbank, and it was so helpful to the Reichsbank, the Nazi central bank, that Emil Poole, the vice president of the Reichsbank and a BIS director, said that the BIS was the Reichsbank's only foreign branch. So all of this was being watched in the States, especially by Henry Morgenthau, the Treasury Secretary, and his assistant, Harry Dexter White. And they pushed very hard at Bretton Woods for the bank to be closed down. And although it was agreed that it would be, no date was set, so it never happened.
Well, that's so interesting, strange, isn't it? Absolutely fascinating. Martin, the bank shouldn't exist. It was an attempt to close it down after World War II by the Americans. In fact, they passed a resolution at Bretton Woods saying we've got to get rid of this bank because it was funding Hitler.
Yes, but what happened subsequently is that they thought Stalin was more of a threat, and therefore the ex-Nazi structures, whatever they were integrated into the Western structures. So through Operation Paperclip, lots of ex-Nazis ended up living in Latin America, and that was winked at by the Western intelligence services because, the game had moved on, and suddenly we're not fighting the Germans anymore, so the Bank of International Settlements stays as part of our team.
Well, we've heard of the IMF, International Monetary Fund. We've heard of the World Bank. Why haven't we heard of this bank, the BIS, Bank for International Settlements, which is actually far more important as a meeting place and a policy-making place for all the central banks of the world?
I don't think it's clear who actually pulls the strings behind these opaque structures.
Well, Mark Carney is pulling the strings. He's chairing the Financial Stability Board, which is looking at basically drawing up policy. Another policy-making body, the Committee on the Global Financial System, he's also chairing that.
Well, more importantly, he used to be a Goldman Sachs partner, like all of them. And that's what people have got to recognise, is that we've got the intertwining of private and public interests here. And when our correspondent there was saying, well, you can't have central banks run by governments because governments might want to stoke up mini-booms to get elected and so on, well, that's what used to happen in Britain, whether it was the Conservative or Labour Party in power. What they tried to do was engineer a mini-boom before elections. It was normal practice. Now, of course, you could argue that that's bad practice, but it was normal practice in the past. Where it was the Bank of England was only made independent by Gordon Brown. Before that, it had to obey orders.
Well, these central bankers, one of the things we know they're talking about, we're not allowed to know anything else, but one of the things Adam's found out, Adam Libori was speaking to me from Hungary earlier this week there, the stupidity of the finance ministers and the quality of the wine. Well, hang on a minute, but those finance ministers are there to represent us, not them.
Well, this is the problem all through the whole system, isn't it? Is that there are two constituencies that people in power are dealing with. One is the general population, who they have to keep happy somehow or other, and the other is the people with the money, who are the people who really call the shots.
So are these...
So they're constantly being pulled in two directions.
So are these people, the central bankers meeting at the BIS in secret, are they public servants or not?
Well, they're public servants who also work in the private sector and go back to work in the private sector and so on. So in actual fact, the interests they represent are not those of the community at large. Perhaps we should nationalise the whole lot and make the banking sector run by and for the community.
Anyway, that book is out last week. It's called The Tower of Basel, The Shadowy History of the Secret Bank That Runs the World, the inside story of the central banker's secret bank, by Adam Leboi, L-E-B-O-I, who was speaking to me there early this week from Hungary.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. If you'd like to contact me for suggestions for future shows, or indeed any other reason, email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Another brave man, they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like the Bible and the prophets suggest. Men that go riding to help these poor workers, the rich will listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Palestine is still the issue, by historian Ilan Pappé. Professor Ilan Pappé is the best-known member of Israel's generation of new historians. They have been rewriting the history of Israel's founding in 1948. Thanks to the declassification of British and Israeli documents in the 1980s, Pappé has dedicated himself to exposing the myth around what Israel calls its war of independence. That war led to the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians and the destruction of over 500 of their villages in what is now Israel. That's described in Pappé's seminal book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, published in 2006, while he was chair of the Institute for Palestinian and Israeli Studies at Haifa University. The publication led to personal attacks on him in the Israeli Knesset and in Israel's academia. After threats on his person, Pappé left Israel in 2008 and was welcomed at the University of Exeter in Britain. There, he's currently the director of the university's European Center for Palestine Studies. Pappé says that reconciliation between Palestinians and Israelis in a future peace process must be based on an investigation of war crimes committed by Israel in 1948. Pappé supports the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, for an economic and political boycott of Israel. He believes boycotts are justified because, quote, the Israeli occupation is a dynamic process and becomes worse with each passing day. He hopes to see, quote, a historical movement similar to the anti-apartheid campaign against the white supremacist regime in South Africa. This can move us forward along the only remaining viable and nonviolent road to saving both Palestinians and Israelis from an impending catastrophe. End quote. At the time of partition, the Jewish population owned less than 6% of Palestine. When Israel declared its independence in 1948, it came into existence on 78% of historic Palestine, a percentage it has steadily increased in subsequent years, a process that continues today. In 1967, Israel occupied the remaining 22% of historic Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza, as well as large sections of Syria and Egypt. Since then, through financial incentives, Israel has encouraged its citizens and Jewish immigrants from abroad to move into occupied Palestine, creating exclusively Jewish settlements which are illegal according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. Today, 40% of the Palestinian West Bank is off-limits to Palestinians. As of December 2015, about 800,000 Israeli Jews resided over the 1949 armistice lines. That's the West Bank, including predominantly Palestinian East Jerusalem, where the building of new Jewish housing and the expulsion of Palestinians have provoked international criticism, as well as from the White House. While still living in Israel, Pape initiated the annual Israeli Right of Return conferences. They called for the unconditional right of return of Palestinian refugees who were expelled in 1948. Many of them still live in refugee camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, but they have not given up hope of returning to their homeland. For all this, Ilan Pape has not only been attacked, but has gained the respect of the younger generation of activists and that of notable writers, among them the international journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. Pilger calls him, quote, Israel's bravest, most principled, most incisive historian. And Noam Chomsky recently co-wrote a book with Pape, Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. The May 2016 speech by Ilan Pape, Palestine is Still the Issue, that you are about to hear, explains Pape's positions, including his remedy. Since Israel has already annexed almost all of Palestine, there's no longer an option for a two-state solution. Pape says the solution is one state for all its inhabitants, and he lays out some of the basics. Ilan Pape spoke on May 2, 2016, at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, California. He was the keynote speaker at the anniversary celebration of the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECA, a nonprofit humanitarian aid organization based in Berkeley. Since 1988, MECA has provided more than $21 million in food, medicine, medical supplies, and clothes, as well as books, toys, and school supplies to children and families in Palestine, Iraq, and Lebanon. Ilan Pape was introduced by Mona Halabi.
In his groundbreaking book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Ilan Pape accuses the State of Israel of forcibly driving out over 750,000 Palestinians between 1948 and 1949. As part of a long-standing Zionist plan to manufacture an ethnically pure Jewish state. His book had a profound effect on me and on all the Palestinians in the diaspora, because it acknowledged and recorded with honesty and courage our loss and displacement. I am the daughter of a Nakba refugee. I too was fortunate enough to have a mother who instilled in me her love of Palestine. 3 years after her death, this past summer in Jerusalem, I finally managed for the first time ever to enter my mother's house, now inhabited by an Israeli family. I could have shut my eyes and walked from room to room without running into any walls. My mother's memories had become my own. We Palestinians may have lost our homes in 1948, but I like to believe in the end we will return. It's inevitable. Please help me welcome Professor Ilan Pape.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be a keynote speaker in an event on behalf of Mecca. I was introduced to Mecca many years ago when one of my sons told me there is a bus that came to visit us, and they all entered our house. And since then, I followed very closely what Mecca is doing, and it's a great honor to support this sacred work. I also want to thank Mona for this very moving introduction. It's always rewarding to hear Palestinians refer to the ethnic cleansing as an affirmation of their own trials and tribulation in a way that I think also opens some hope for the future. Tonight's title comes under the headline of Palestine is Still the Issue. When I say that Palestine is still the issue, I don't mean that for anyone who sits in this hall or for me, Palestine ever ceased to be the issue. We don't have to be lectured in any way or persuaded that Palestine is still the issue. Every day brings with it a different image that reminds us that Palestine is still the issue. The most recent image I'm taking with me everywhere I go is the photograph of 12-year-old Dima, who spent 75 days in Israeli jail. The day she was released, the desperation on her parents' face in the face of a ruthless ruler who can do whatever he wants with their children, and the very heartbreaking words of Dima, who said, "All I want to do is go back to my friends in school." So we don't need to be reminded that Palestine is still the issue. But I think you understand that the context of this talk is different. A lot of people would tell us that given what's going on in Syria, in Iraq, given the magnitude of the refugee issue in Europe, the economic problems in the United States, Palestine has been marginalized as an issue of global attention, and you cannot galvanize any more people to see Palestine as a central issue of humanity and inhumanity. And I think it is important to remind ourselves why Palestine, in this respect, despite all the horrific things that are happening in Syria and Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, and despite the problems facing refugees in Europe and here as well, despite all of these distractions, if you want, it is important to remind ourselves that Palestine is the issue because much of what we see in the Middle East and outside the Middle East is connected to what happened in the past in Palestine and what happens today in Palestine. So in this respect, if you are still committed to Palestine with all your heart, most of your activity is on behalf of the Palestinians and for the Palestinians, you are also acting on behalf of everyone else who nowadays suffers in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East from crimes against humanity. Palestine is the issue for five major reasons, and I would like to point out each one of them. Palestine is still the issue today because morally it is the last and only remaining struggle of indigenous native people against settler colonialism that is still very active. Palestine is not the only country where settler colonialism was visited upon. This very country we are in was one of the first projects of settler colonialism. Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. But in all these other countries where settler colonialism was definitely prevalent in the past, at least processes of change and transformation were taking place. Palestine is the only active remaining act of settler colonialism, and therefore it is representing the struggle of indigenous people and native people all around the world. Settler colonialism, as you may know, is the movement of desperate Europeans outside of Europe because they were persecuted there, because they felt that Europe was unsafe. And they went to other countries, to other continents. And when they arrived in those new places, they found an indigenous native population. Because they were persecuted, because they were looking for one-way ticket out of Europe, they felt that they don't only want to make the new country a home, but also to make it a homeland. The obstacle in the way of making a new place a homeland were always the indigenous native people. In many cases, the result of this clash between the wish to create a new homeland and the fact that someone else already lived there for centuries was genocide, elimination of the native people. We have to remind ourselves and remain hopeful that Palestine is still the issue because people were not genocided there. Because there in Palestine, the logic of elimination that informed settler colonialism in this country was terrible enough, but was not genocide. People were expelled, villages were destroyed, the country was de-Arabized and Judaized. But the struggle continues because the people are still there, because not all the country has been de-Arabized, and because the people themselves have not lost the struggle and the wish to go back to their homeland, and those who are in their homeland have not lost the aspiration to make it once more their beloved homeland. So this is a struggle that brings together the evils of settler colonialism in the past with the evil of colonialism in the present. And in this respect, if we want to be part of a better world that understands that European settlers wreaked havoc, genocide, apartheid, ethnic cleansing all around the rest of the world, it is in Palestine where we can still rectify some of that evil by showing that there is a way towards reconciliation, as was done at least partly in post-apartheid South Africa. So morally, Palestine is the place where the logic of elimination is still at work daily against the Palestinian people, and everyone who experienced it here in the past or still thinks about it can see in Palestine a place where this logic should be rejected and replaced by humanization. Settler colonialism is also a human project that was motivated by dehumanization. People who were chased out of Europe and arrived in a place where someone else lived were usually poor people, persecuted people, victims of ethnic cleansing themselves. And in order to justify their transformation into victimizers themselves, they had to dehumanize the native people. They had to dehumanize the indigenous people. Zionism in Palestine is this lethal fusion of these two logics that still operates in 2016, where Palestinians are dehumanized and therefore are an object of elimination. Elimination is not always physical genocide. You can be eliminated by being enclaved and besieged in your own village without the right to move. You can be eliminated by being expelled within your own homeland to another place. You can be eliminated by being robbed of all your civil rights, either to vote or to be elected in a way that can have an impact on your own future. So in this respect, we are witnessing daily the experiment of settler colonialism in Palestine, motivated by these two logic of dehumanization and elimination. And if we are against such inhumanity, then Palestine should be the issue for us. Palestine is also the issue because it has been connected and associated in the most wrong way possible with anti-Semitism. For so many years, we were led to believe that the colonization of Palestine was the antidote to anti-Semitism. Europe, the United States, and the West in general used to convince themselves and others that because there was a problem of anti-Semitism, and its worst chapter was in Europe during the Holocaust, the only way to solve the hatred towards Jews because they are Jews was to allow them to colonize Palestine and dispossess the Palestinians. This irrational, this cruel logic that is at the heart of the connection between Zionism and anti-Semitism still fuels most of the support Israel gets in this country and still is the main ammunition pro-Israeli groups and individuals use in this country to silence any criticism on the Jewish state and its criminal policies. And therefore, Palestine, and that's the second reason that Palestine is still the issue, because the Jewish problem of Europe, the Jewish problem of the West, is a universal problem. It was not only the problem of the Jews. The genocide of the Jews in the Second World War showed the cruelty of modernity, of European enlightenment, of the aspiration of Europeans to be culturally, morally, and politically superior to any other civilization. We need a closure to that terrible chapter in the history of humanity. Allowing Jews to colonize Palestine and dispossess the Palestinian is not the answer for this problem. I don't think today there's much anti-Semitism in the world anyway, but we need to make sure that people have a different conversation about the connection between anti-Semitism and Zionism and Palestine. The Zionization of Palestine increased anti-Semitism, did not led to its disappearance. A democratic, free Palestine for all is the best antidote to anti-Semitism. And we have to talk to our Jewish friends. And we have to be honest with our Jewish friends who still believe that Israel, for some reason, is this insurance company that would be waiting for them should the Holocaust appear again in this country or elsewhere. We have to explain to them that this is not an insurance company. This is a company that destroys and demolishes other people's life, and you don't want to be associated with such an insurance company. Your insurance is in a just, equitable, democratic United States of America, not in a powerful settler colonial state of Israel. Palestine is still the issue because it is connected also to Islamophobia. It has a long history of connection to the fear of Muslims just because they are Muslims. The Balfour Declaration, in which Britain gave something that didn't belong to it, to a movement it didn't belong to. The two motives for the British Empire to take part of the Middle East, part of the Arab world, part of the Muslim world, and to grant it to a new ideological movement and promise that the empire would do its utmost to create a homeland there, the two major motives were, surprisingly, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. There was a fear of Islam, there was a fear of Muslims, very much at the heart of the British policymakers who were about to take the Middle East as a new possession in the empire that already was very big. And they much preferred to have non-Muslim enclaves and kingdoms, if they could, in the new domains, in the new possessions. And at the same time, it was a double bill as far as the Jews were concerned. Here were a group of Jews who came to them and said, we want to leave Europe and to colonize Palestine. This was good news for someone like Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary. He could see how he can get rid of the Jews and at the same time have a non-Muslim British colony in the Holy Land, which he hoped one day would be restored to the glory of the days of the Crusaders. So Islamophobia, in many ways, or put it differently, Palestinians were the first victims of Islamophobia in modern times. They are also the last victims of Islamophobia in our times. It is the fear of Islam, it is the hatred of Islam, it is the animosity to Muslims just because they are Muslims that helped Israel to stop almost a natural process in the United States at the very end of the last century, in which Americans, because of the easy access to information, to knowledge, began to understand what was going on the ground in Palestine. It was the major tool by which Israel, after 2001, associated terrorism with Palestinians in a way that stifled any proper discussion about Israel, Zionism, and Palestine in this country. And we are witnessing it again and again, the attempt to associate violence that is carried out by desperate people in Europe and their supporters with justification for the state terror that Israel exercises against the Palestinians. So if you have a discussion about Palestine, you have a genuine discussion about terror, not a false discussion about terror. You have a genuine discussion about the causes of violence, both in the Middle East, in Brussels, in Paris, in the United States, and everywhere in the world. You have a much better conversation on how Palestine is connected to desperation, to violence, if you focus on that country and you don't allow the conversation about terror and the Islamophobic discourse to stifle any genuine discussion about the systematic structure violation of human rights against the Palestinian that has started in the late 19th century and has not stopped for even one day.
That was the first part of a 45-minute speech by Ilan Pappé, Israeli historian and currently director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter in Britain. He was the keynote speaker at the May 2016 anniversary celebration of the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, a nonprofit humanitarian aid organization based in Berkeley, California. Professor Ilan Pappé is the author of many books, most famously The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, London and New York, 2006, as well as The Forgotten Palestinians, A History of the Palestinians in Israel, Yale University Press, 2011. Ilan Pape was recorded by Jeff Blankford on May 2, 2016, at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley, California. Come back for the conclusion when Pape explains how Palestine is connected to the international universal issues of social justice and human rights. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gloden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
I also think that if we can do this, if we can basically create a global social movement for a fair, effective solution to climate change, it'll be an overwhelming example of what it is that people can accomplish when they simply do it themselves and do not assume that the elites that are supposed to be leading us sensibly, you know, leave the decisions to them. Because they have boggled this so badly that we have to solve it ourselves. And if we succeed in doing that, the example of successful popular mobilization solving great human problems will be so overwhelmingly positive that it will just lead to all sorts of other things, you know, that we can accomplish.
That's the voice of radical economist, professor, and author Dr. Robin Hinnell. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Hinnell about charting a road forward and the importance of a global social movement against climate change. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. We're very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robin Hinnell. He is the author of The People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economics, now available in Spanish. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you again, Sylvia.
Now, when we think about the world and the kinds of economic practices through which we're invited to envision the world, you know, we have been socialized in a world that presents capitalism as a natural occurrence, something that just happened and that we're all now invited to participate. But I think in understanding our relationship with the world, we also need to understand the relationship that global capitalism has had with imperialism and how the two kind of interconnect. How do we then break out of a system of capitalism that reduces us to consumers?
Imperialism long preceded capitalism. There were empires where different groups of people dominated, conquered, and subjugated other groups of people long before capitalism. But in modern times, capitalism has become more global and more integrated. It's penetrated literally every little nook and corner of the planet, not just geographically, but the parts of our lives. Increasingly, our lives are basically driven as a market-driven process. The parts of our lives that really were separate from the capitalist economy have shrunk, even in societies that were capitalist. And then geographically, capitalism has spread every place. With the demise of the so-called socialist bloc, capitalism has rapidly spread into Russia, China, And therefore, what's happened and what's clear now is that imperialism and global capitalism are really all one. We now have achieved a level of integration of not only just global capitalism, but how it is that the imperialist aspects of today's world are intertwined with the globalist capitalist project. That's what we're witnessing. That's the era that we are now in. Of course, it's leading to misery for humans, increasingly so, because it's become an increasingly irrational kind of global capitalism. It's fomenting wars, you know, that now are increasing in violence and death tolls. And it's, you know, hell-bent on destroying the natural environment and creating climate change that it may prove impossible to recover from. So the urgency of replacing global imperialist capitalism, you know, has never been greater.
Our actions are not taken in a vacuum, you know, and they affect one another. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact then that our movements to reject this notion of our whole being being one of consumption and production and interconnecting to a different vision of the world, one of communal integration, of communal participation, where we're both the recipients of reciprocal respect, but we also have a responsibility to create and connect that lead to coexistence, that lead to sustainability and in a world with justice, not just for our own little corner, but for all people.
We do live in a more interconnected world. And I mean, this is a debate amongst those who study the globalization process. One reaction to the globalization process, because it has been organized and conducted in a way that is so destructive of local communities and cultures, is to reject integration of any kind. And that's very natural and understandable. And sometimes that's the practical thing that one must do. You must basically try and protect your community, your country, you know, from the destructive process of neoliberal capitalist globalization. On the other hand, there's a positive vision of globalization, which is one of increasing equitable cooperation amongst people everywhere, including knowledge and awareness of other people's cultures far, far beyond what people were capable of having 100 years ago. That's what makes the thinking through how to respond sometimes very difficult. The big picture is that we know what's fair and we know what's just and we know what democracy means and entails. And as long as we remember that that's what we're fighting for, and as long as we remember that what global capitalism and imperialism about, what they are about is the economics of competition and greed and the process of domination of one people by some other groups. That's what we have to defeat. That's what we have to organize and defeat before it's too late. And instead, we have to continue to develop more and more ways of actually growing and behaving in a way that is true to our values and our desires. And I just call that the economics of equitable cooperation. And in terms of imperial relations, it's basically peaceful coexistence amongst friendly peoples. That's the vision on the other side that we have to understand. That's what we're fighting for against all the odds.
Can we talk a little bit about the significance of one good example? And perhaps we could use Venezuela, or we can use Bolivia, or you can choose. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how do we break out this prison, you know, of imagining the world simply along the lines of what has been imposed. I was thinking about, you know, the ultimate authority sometimes is just the unquestioned beliefs that we participate in, the things that we just take for granted and fall into.
But I think that people's ability to think about alternatives has clearly increased over the past 10 to 15 years. There's an increasing curiosity on the part of younger generations. Positive examples are very, very important. It's not sufficient to say, theoretically, I can show you there's a different way that's a better way. You actually have to demonstrate the practical reality of that. But we're getting more of that, too. Some people call it the future economy. Some people call it the new economy. There are two things going on in two different parts of the world. Places like Latin America and places in the countries called the BRICS, they are, first of all, standing up to European, North American-led global imperialism. They're saying, we're not going to put up with that anymore. We're no longer just your tools to be manipulated. And that's for the good. Also within their countries, and within many of those countries, they are experimenting with new and better ways to do things that actually are better for the environment and more humane and better for their populaces. Inside Europe and the United States and Canada and North America and Europe, as neoliberalism persists, even despite the crisis it's created, more and more people in local areas are discovering, well, we're just going to have to pick up and do things ourselves, and we're going to do them in the ways that make sense to us. So we have more and more examples of that's the kind of economics that works, that serves people's needs and protects the environment. And neoliberal capitalism doesn't work. It's on a destruction path.
It's beautiful when we think about the BRICS country, you know, Brazil, Russia, China, India, South Africa. I mean, these are countries heavily populated where the numbers of people alone speak to the volume of a new idea. But I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the principles then that we need to have in place for a participatory economic, one that begins from the bottom up, one that, you know, propels us to see the world in precisely this egalitarian, collaborative nature that you're speaking of.
Well, the principles have been ones around for a long, long time. You know, the French Revolution was liberty, equality, and solidarity. And this predates, really, the socialist movement of the century that followed the French Revolution. And those have been the ideals of people fighting for a better world for a long, long time now. And being clear about, well, when we say we want democracy, we want political democracy, and does democracy have to be confined to the political sphere of social life? Most of us spend most of our life in economic activities. And is there some reason that those decisions can't also be made in a democratic way? And is a democratic way also need to be vibrant and grassroots and participatory rather than representative? Can you organize it so it will be that way? We have to think clearly about democracy and decision-making and what we want. And, you know, one of the good things in this area is we live in a more educated world than the world has ever been before. In human history, the percentage of the population who have been taught enough so that they are capable of understanding what's going on and making decisions for themselves that are sensible, sound decisions, the percentage of the population globally that is capable of that has been increasing dramatically. And I think that one of the things that will happen over the next century is they will demand the right to exercise an ability that they now have. We need to remember that we can do all this fairly and justly and treat one another fairly and justly. And if we don't, it leads to problems. And what it is that requires thinking that through. And then remembering that at this point, this has to be done urgently, you know, in a way that is consistent with preventing climate change and then going on to protect the planet and the natural environment in ways that humans have never, never done. Those are the things that we need to concentrate on. And if we always keep very clearly in mind that those are the goals, that's the criteria that we judge different programs and actions against, then I think we steer right, and I think that eventually will prevail.
As an environmentalist economist, you challenge us to look at the world in a more integrated way, you know, where our social movements need to have both, you know, this political economy in our minds, but also our connection to the land, our connection to the kinds of process that we're putting forward as, you know, practical ways of creating jobs. So where are the shifts that we need to make as a society?
Well, I think one of the concepts that the founders of the ecological economics movement provided that's very, very useful, and he said that, you know, for a long time, humans lived in a mostly empty world, but now we live in a mostly full world, and the difference is immense. Now, what's interesting is when we lived in a mostly empty world, we, for the most part, acted in very destructive ways. vis-a-vis the natural environment. But the natural environment was so, so big and huge and resilient compared to the magnitude of the negative effects of human activities for most human history that it just didn't matter that much. But now that's no longer the case. We now live in a world where the environmental consequences of everything we do has to be very, very carefully considered and calibrated. And the other thing that in this area that I think is overwhelmingly becoming clearer is that the environmental movements as they arose, you know, in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, climate change was not the principal motivator of environmental organizations, NGOs, and environmental activism. And so a lot of environmental activism has been focused on local attempts to protect particular parts of the environment, or to prevent certain kinds of pollution. But we now understand that we have created an environmental threat that really overwhelms all of the others. Imagine if every environmental group was completely successful in protecting this river, the salmon species here, we bring them back, we knock the dams down, that was all a mistake, we recreate Salmon Nation in the Northwest, British Columbia, Oregon, Washington State, Northern California. Even if we were successful at doing all that, if we do not prevent cataclysmic climate change over the next 100 years, all of the environmental gains that have been gained locally, all of those improvements, are just going to be wiped away. So we absolutely have got to respond to this new challenge. And the powers that be, the global elites, the international negotiations, the legislative, the political parties, we're getting no action on this front. In Washington, D.C., there's gridlock on this issue. In Europe, it's been put on the back burner. In Canada, it's been buried, the need for tourism and exploiting natural resources. At the international negotiations level, we've been taking steps backwards. So there is no choice but trying to organize a massive global movement to solve the climate change problem before it's too late. I also think that if we can do this, if we can basically create a global social movement for a fair, effective solution to climate change, it'll be an overwhelming example of what it is that people can accomplish when they simply do it themselves and do not assume that the elites that are supposed to be leading us sensibly, you know, leave the decisions to them. Because they have boggled this so badly that we have to solve it ourselves. And if we succeed in doing that, the example of successful popular mobilization solving great human problems will be so overwhelmingly positive that it will just lead to all sorts of other things, you know, that we can accomplish as this century moves along. But if we do not solve that problem by the end of the century, the planet's not going to be worth living in. And if we do solve the problem, it'll be because people solved it. And that will be a wonderful, positive example for humanity.
You know, one of the things that I'm very concerned about is when sometimes even those who are supposed to be on the progressive side entertain ideas that, you know, we treat the problem as if it was an equal divide, you know. We know that 90% of the population agrees that climate change is real, that we need to act, we don't have a way to deal with nuclear waste, and so we should stop that project. We know that coal mines, you know, are completely disastrous to a lot of our local economies, you know, natural economies, because an economy is not just money bartering, changing hands. An economy is also a living economy, you know, a river, a beautiful lake, you know, that has multiple beings that you can feed from and, you know, be part of. It's also an economy, you know, a different kind of community that we all benefit from. So what are the alternatives? You know, what are the alternatives and the things that we as communities engage must now take on without this nonsense of sitting on the fence of, you know, but 10% say that it's this and treat it as if it was, you know, an equal divide of ideas, but rather instead of taking decisive action to move in the direction of creating a world that's ecologically, socially, culturally, politically sustainable.
The scientific community is just remarkably unanimous about the seriousness of the threat of climate change. and remarkably unanimous about the degree to which we have simply got to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, incredibly rapidly. So from people who studied this, the scientific experts, we don't have a tremendous amount of disagreement. Now, in the United States, the fossil fuel industry is they have funded some think tanks, and they have funded phony research that, quotes itself back and forth to pretend that there's, there are two sides to this issue amongst the scientists. That is a bunch of malarkey. There are no two sides on this issue among scientists. In terms of political interests, it's really the fossil fuel industry against the world. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who have everything to lose because they own the assets that are under the ground. And what the scientists are telling us is you cannot take them out and burn them. If you do that, the planet is destroyed. So, of course, they are doing absolutely everything they can. And in the United States, the fossil fuel industry has been the most powerful, successful political lobby in the history of the country. It has run energy policy for 150 years or more in this country, and it continues to do so and obstruct progress. On the other hand, ordinary people are not just aghast at the fact that nothing is being done. There are more and more businesses and industries that are discovering that, oh my God, the fossil fuel industry is just going to take us all down. So the possibilities of doing something, there are many, many positive aspects of what it is that we can do, and there's many reasons to be hopeful. But one of the things we have to do is we have to be much more successful at waging political battles and warfare. In this area, it's really important that radicals who believe in system change learn how to work constructively with people who are absolutely dedicated to preventing climate change, but who have not yet decided whether or not they think this requires system change. We can't have radicals saying, well, I'm not going to even participate in a fight around any sort of campaign to stop climate change unless they are calling for system change, because everybody knows capital. Well, I know that capitalism is the problem. That's what's causing climate change. So unless you're going to call for replacement of capitalism, there can't be any solution. And then you have many, many more people who, haven't gotten the message that capitalism needs to be replaced. And they're out there fighting in all sorts of very practical ways to try and do things to stop this problem. We have to do a much better job of seeing that the reformers and the radicals do not undercut one another. We each have our job. We each have things we can do well to stop climate change, and we need to all do that in a more collaborative and cooperative way, or else we are going to get beat by the world's most successful lobby, and that's the fossil fuel industry globally.
That's beautiful, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because I think we need everybody, and we don't all have the same lived experience. We haven't all lived next to a mine that completely, undermined the livelihood and the lives of the people there. So sometimes the idea of system change hasn't yet occurred to us because our lived experience has not been so dire, and it takes some time to get there. But I think, as you point out, we need everybody, and the more we can collaborate and cooperate with each other, the more successful we will be. Please tell our audience, how can people access your book, Of the People, By the People, A Case for a Participatory Economy?
Well, it's distributed by AK Press. As you said, there's a Spanish language edition now for people who speak Spanish. That was published by a press called Icaria Press. It's in Barcelona, Spain. And you should always try and get books through some sort of left progressive media distributor, bookstore, or whatever, because it's important that we keep an alternative media alive. And the Amazons of the world are killing them. On the other hand, if you have no other way to get these books, you, of course, can get them through Amazon. And the other book for people who are primarily concerned or interested with climate change and solutions to climate change and environmental issues, Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis, that's published by M.E. Sharp. That's also available in left progressive bookstores and through the regular outlets. I'm happy to say there's now some foreign language editions of the Green Economics. Turkey has a new brand new foreign language edition of the Green Economics book, because in Turkey they're taking this issue very seriously.
Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for not only participating but helping us create alternatives to how we organize, how we mobilize, and how we celebrate our journey together, because I think ultimately this needs to be a journey where we see each other and embrace our diversity as, you know, the strength of our movement. So thank you so much for all that you do to make us aware of the beautiful movements that are all over and that inform our steps as we move forward.
As always, it was a pleasure to be with you, and I do believe that Cascadia has an important role to lead the way and in the way forward.
Thank you again. We will be at the Cascadia Media Conference on September 19th to the 21st. And if you're interested, come. You get to meet Dr. Robin Hanel in person. Hopefully you'll have books there as well.
I'll try to do that.
Take care. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Talking to you, Sylvia. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of Of the People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economics. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.